There it is. Already.
I just don't have any door knocking to do.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation to order. For the record, it's September 9th. Let's see. And Patrick, you had some introductory things.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair.
September 15th, excuse me.
We wanted to let you know a couple of things. One thing, there's been a change to the recording system that we use here in the hearing rooms. We've moved over to a system called Granicus. So it just changes a little bit about how the flashing light works. We used to call that the blue flashing light. It no longer flashes. So that light is either on. When the light is on, it means the mics are live and it's recording. And when it's off, it's not. But there's usually a delay. After a gavel, we'll turn the system off, and sometimes it can take a few seconds. So make sure you're keeping an eye for the light so that you'll know when the mics are off. That's all we want. We wanted to make sure y'all knew that.
Okay.
And then the second thing is our office has just finished putting out the 2014 edition of what we call the background briefs. They're a series of about 90 different briefing papers on all sorts of subjects in all committee areas. So there's one of those that's probably the most relevant for today's freight and passenger rail, since we're going to be talking about oil trains later today. Those are on the OregonLegislature.gov website under Citizen Engagement Publications.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Anything else for the good of order before we dive in here? Seeing none, okay. We'll open an information hearing on the update on climate smart communities and scenario project. And Patrick, do you have any introductory comments?
Ms. Chair, I believe we're going to have some folks from JPACT and the Metro Policy Advisory Committee come brief us on there, and they're approaching as we speak.
Welcome.
I should mention, your PACs do have their testimony and presentation, and it should also be up on OLIS.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about the Climate Smart Communities Scenarios Project. My name is Jody Carson, and I have served on the Westland City Council for the last 8 years, and since 2009 I've been a member of the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, or MPAC, which includes public officials and citizens from around the Portland metropolitan region and advises the Metro Council on matters of regional concern. During this last year, I have served as the chair of MPAC. I'd like to give you a brief overview of the Climate Smart Communities Scenarios Project and then turn things over to Metro Councilor Craig Dirksen to give you a more detailed explanation of the current status of the project. In the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act, JTA, the legislature directed Metro to develop two or more scenarios under which the Portland metropolitan region could achieve the greenhouse gas reduction targets by 2035 with respect to light-duty vehicles, and that would be basically cars and light trucks. The JTA requires Metro to select one of these scenarios for implementation, and then it requires that local governments of the Portland region modify their local plans to be consistent with that adopted scenario. While the region has committed to addressing climate change, this mandate has created a lot of anxiety amongst the cities in the region. I can tell you that a lot of the elected officials were very concerned about what kind of unfunded requirements Metro would come up with, and I'm sure that the Metro Council was concerned as well. Today, I am pleased to tell you that these fears are unfounded, and that with your help, our region can achieve the targets given and improve our economy and quality of life. On the back of the brochure, and I think you all have a color copy of that brochure, on the back you can see that the project has three phases. Phase one was a technical exercise where Metro tested dozens of scenarios that involved different combinations of actions to see what strategies made the most difference in terms of the greenhouse gas emissions. This phase did not address any political or financial feasibility or tell us exactly how to move forward. It did show us one important thing. It is actually possible to achieve the target. In phase two, Metro decided to step back and reframe the entire project around plans and visions that had already been adopted throughout the region, not just the regional transportation plan and the 2040 growth concept, but also local comprehensive plans and transportation plans that express the visions and aspirations of the local communities throughout the region. These plans have been adopted not to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but to improve the lives of people in their communities by supporting economic prosperity, providing safe, convenient transportation choices, protecting our air and water quality, and creating vibrant, livable communities. So based on this revised approach in phase two, Metro tested the local and regional plans against the 2035 target. What they found was the plans that have been adopted to reach our local community goals are enough to meet the target if we make the investments needed to implement those plans. Metro found that to achieve the state's greenhouse gas reduction targets for light vehicles, we don't have to turn our lives upside down. We just need to find the resources to implement the existing land use and transportation plans we've adopted to create healthy and prosperous communities. Also, basing this effort on local plans means that Metro will not be imposing a one-size-fits-all standard on the local communities, but that each community will be able to carry out its own responsibilities in ways that are consistent with their own plans and visions. Now we are on the third and final phase of the project, where we are more carefully analyzing a draft preferred scenario that was created by gathering a lot of input from local governments of the region. That scenario has just gone out for public comment this week, September 15th, and Councillor Dirksen will be talking more about that later. This is what we've learned from the third phase. The costs of implementing this draft approach are significant. However, the preliminary indications are that the economic and health benefits of this approach on a household level actually exceed the costs. In summary, in phase one, we learned that the targets are technically achievable. In phase two, we learned that we can achieve them if we make the investments to implement our own existing plans. And in phase three, we are learning that if, when you take all the costs and benefits into account, we may actually come out ahead economically by doing what it takes to achieve the target. Implementing our existing plans, however, will not be easy. If we keep investing at the current levels, we will not achieve the targets that we have been given. While we are willing to play our part in generating necessary resources, we can't do it without your help. We know people are working to develop potential transportation package for 2015 that would enable us to make significant multimodal investments in our transportation system. We look forward to working with you as you move forward on this package. If we are able to make the investments in roads, transit, sidewalks, bike paths, and innovative technology that we have already planned to make, we can demonstrate that our addressing climate change is not only possible, but in doing so, it'll actually make our communities better and our lives better. I would now like to turn this over to Councillor Dirksen.
Thank you, Councillor. Good morning, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name's Craig Dirksen. I've been a member of the Metro Council now for nearly 2 years. Since January, I've served as the chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation, or JPAC, a seat that was once filled by Senator Monroe. JPAC brings together elected officials and agency leaders from the entire three-county Portland metropolitan area to make transportation policy and funding decisions in collaboration with the Metro Council. It also serves as the federally designated metropolitan planning organization for the region, again in partnership with the Council. I also served on JPAC in my previous position as the mayor of the city of Tigard, where I represented all of the cities of Washington County. Now, having sat through just about as many meetings and presentations of the Climate Smart Communities Scenarios project as anyone in the region, or for that matter on the planet, I would guess, I'm pleased to report today that we are nearing the completion of the project, and with any luck, that will culminate in the adoption of a preferred strategy by the Metro Council in December of this year, which is required by our mandate. We still have a lot of work to do, but make no mistake, adoption of a widely supported approach will constitute a major accomplishment and one that no one was certain was achievable when the project began. As Councillor Carson said early in the project, there was a lot of anxiety at the local level. And as a city official myself during that phase of the project, I was as apprehensive as anyone about what kinds of draconian measures might be required to achieve the state greenhouse gas emissions targets. But as Councillor Carson noted, Metro listened to the concerns of its local partners, and we grounded the project in strategies that are already part of communities' existing plans. The fact that we can reach the target if we fully implement our existing plans constitutes a significant endorsement of the Portland Metro Region's approach to growth management. It basically means that what we were already doing for other reasons, supporting compact development to protect farm and forest land, focusing development in active downtowns, in town centers, and on main streets, providing for a variety of housing choices, and investing in the full range of transportation options has had the happy and originally unintended effect of significantly reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and putting us on a trajectory to achieve the state's aggressive goal for 2035 in ways that actually enhance rather than undermine our economy and our communities. Allow me to walk you briefly through the brochure that we've distributed, which includes the latest findings from our analysis of the draft approach. As you can see from the graphic on page one, the state targets represents a reduction in per capita emissions of 20% below 2005 levels, and that's after subtracting reductions expected from factors that are beyond the region's control, namely changes like in fuel technology, vehicle mix, and also from exercising the CAFE fuel efficiency standard. It's important to note that those factors actually get us well over halfway from the 2005 starting point to the 2035 goal. So if you look at the chart there for the three different scenarios, scenario A, we asked ourselves, what would we accomplish if we just keep doing what we're doing and at the level we're doing it? And as it shows, we did not meet the goal. It would only be a 12% reduction. However, we said, what would happen in scenario B? What would happen if we were actually able to implement our adopted plans, assuming we had the funds to do that? We discovered, yes, that would actually meet the goal, not only 20%, but 24%. And then the third scenario was, what else do we know that can be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and what would we achieve if we were to do basically everything we could do, regardless of cost or impact on the economy? And the answer was, you could get a 30%, 36% reduction if you were willing to do all those things. Through evaluation and discussion with our partners, and at the end of two joint meetings between our two committees, between Councillor Carson's MPAC committee and my JPAC committee, we got buy-in from all the representatives in the region for what we call the draft preferred approach. And then we tasked our staff to evaluate what it would achieve. And what we found is the fourth bar, the green bar, the draft approach, which will actually bring us a 29% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions if we do the things that we all admit that we want to do. As Councillor Carson said, the draft approach was developed with input from the members of JPAC and MPAC, as well as the broader community. That approach results in emissions that are roughly between scenario B and C. Now, if you open the brochure, on the left-hand side, it shows what some of the other benefits are if we accomplish this. As you can see, there's improvements to public health and actually economic benefits from that improved health. The top there. More physical activity, less air pollution provide a lot of benefits. We also, the economy benefits from reduced emissions and from reduced delay for things like for commuters in traffic, also for freight. You can see there's a reduction in environmental costs and also essentially a reduction in freight travel costs due to reductions in delay if we're able to move forward with the preferred plan. And one of the other things we discovered, if you look down at the bottom, is that actually the transportation-related costs for families is reduced if we're able to achieve the vision that we have through this process. Actual costs per family go down for transportation as well. The cost of implementation is significant, but benefits are even more significant. We're still crunching the numbers, but preliminary analysis indicates that the economic and health benefits to households of the draft approach actually exceed the additional costs associated with implementing it. If you look on the right-hand side, it asks the hard questions. What's it going to cost? What's the return on investment? And how much are we going to need to invest by 2035 to achieve this goal? The top band, that donut at the top, shows the different modes that would be invested in and what levels of cost there would be to invest in those at the levels needed to achieve the goals we've talked about. The center chart indicates what the estimated costs of the approaches would be. The top is what the cost of the draft approach would be. This is total expenditures between now and 2035 of $24 billion. By comparison, the entire 2014 updated regional transportation plan, if we were to implement in its entirety, would cost about $29 billion. So we actually $5 billion less. Unfortunately, the constrained RTP, what we could anticipate money, funds between now and 2035, we only anticipate we could have $19 billion, so we end up $5 billion short of what would be needed to achieve our goal. And if you look at the bottom chart, it shows where that extra money would go. For streets and highways and capital, about the same amount that we were assuming under the constrained RTP, but increases in transit capital in order to provide the complete transit system that we would need to help support the streets and highway system. Also, transit operations as a result would be, the cost would go up as well. We would spend about the same amount for active transportation that we would under the other proposal, active transportation being improvements to bike facilities, pedestrian facilities, those kinds of things. And then a couple of other things that we looked at that cost very little but have significant impacts, and that is providing better technology to manage the system. You're talking about signal synchronization, those kinds of things. And then also providing travel information and incentives to show people what are the best ways to get around. If you've been in the Portland metro region recently, you've seen where some of that's been achieved, where you have billboards, changing billboards that tell you what travel times are for different routes for where you want to go, those kinds of things. After 4 years of work, we're finding that the barrier to successfully achieving the required reduction in emissions is not resistance to the draft approach. Rather, it is our inability to make the investments needed to carry out our plans. Now, at the regional level, we want to do our part to find the resources necessary to make these investments. You probably know about various conversations and proposals at the city and county levels to raise funds to maintain and expand our road system. Several members of the legislature are already involved in regional conversations about future investments in public transit that will require significant infusions of capital from the region. But we also need your help and your leadership to secure adequate funding for all the transportation modes in Oregon. We're aware of the ongoing efforts of the Oregon Transportation Forum to develop a proposed all-modes transportation package for consideration by the 2015 legislature. While that proposal remains a work in progress, many elements under consideration support the implementation of our draft strategy. We look forward to working with you to advance these elements in ways that will support the development of a sustainable and balanced transportation system that serves all modes and all users, not just in the Portland metropolitan region, but around the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. We also have some members of staff here if you have questions of a technical nature that I might not be able to answer.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Durrett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is 12, if we don't do anything, the trends are moving 12%, and we're going to reduce 12%. And
correct.
I would assume that's conversion to electric and propane and that sort of thing. Did you look in the cost of your plan is $945 million per year. That's not just a little trivial amount. I mean, that's a lot of money.
That's the total. It's not additional needed. It's the total needed. But
oh,
yes.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, but the question is, did you look at any way that we could speed up those trends to propane, natural gas, and electric? That, to me, would be a far less expensive way to go mm-hmm. than what you have outlined here. Was that considered?
Yes and no. It was considered, but not by us. When we were given this task, those issues, how the technology is going to change the vehicle fleet and the pace that that's going to change, we were given by the state certain assumptions. You can assume that alternative energy vehicles will be this percentage. You can assume that your average vehicle will get X number of miles per gallon. You can assume some other things. And then we had to take those assumptions and we had to develop a plan that would make improvements on top of that. We weren't allowed to consider that. We were given figures from the state with consideration of those particular issues, and we had to find other things that needed to be done as well. And that's what our study was based on, is okay. Those things were an assumption, put those in your pocket, and then figure out other things to do as well.
Other questions? Senator Stark?
Thank you. The one place that jumps out at me on the, I guess on the third page of this bottom chart,
yes,
is the huge increase in transit operations costs.
Right.
The metro area, we got one transit operator, so that's TriMet.
Well, we do have the smart bus system in Wilsonville, but yes.
That's correct. Stand corrected. So talk to me a little bit about why this massive increase in the operations side of TriMet.
Well, if you look at the capital side, and you can see that there's a significant increase in what we would need, because we need to still build out the system, which is not yet complete. And so the transit operations side is anticipating that now larger system that would be constructed, and then so the operations for it would be higher than what for the system that we have now, because the system would be larger. There'd be...
So, Mr. Follow-up.
Follow-up,
so, under this scenario, it assumes, I believe, a light rail extension into the Southwest Corridor. Is that correct?
You know, I would have to ask our staff. When we set up the assumptions, was before that plan had been adopted and approved. And since our assumption is based on the approved plans, I don't think that was included.
Okay. That's... Very good.
Let me turn around and see if I can get a nod or a shake from staff. Is that correct?
Chair Beyer, I'm Kim Ellis. I am the project manager for the Climate Smart Communities Project. In terms of the Southwest Corridor, what we have assumed in that corridor, as well as other high-capacity transit corridors identified in our long-range plan, is a bus rapid transit level of investment, acknowledging that the planning work is still underway in that and in other corridors that are under study in the metro region.
Excellent. Perfect. Great. Thank you for that answer.
Thank you. The one you were looking for.
Good answer.
Any other questions?
Well, I think you've identified the big problem, which is transit funding. I've been actively following the transportation forum, and I have to say that we have yet to come up with a funding strategy for non-roads that is going to get anywhere close to this.
It's definitely a challenge. One other thing I would point out to you, and it wasn't part of our presentation, but some of the other information is that's being provided to all of our partners around the region. We have the toolbox that is being provided, a toolbox of possible early actions that could be taken. and it's broken down by who can do what. What can TriMet and Smart do? What can cities and counties do? What can Metro do? There's also a list that says, what can the state do? And there's also a line for policy. This will be actually released today for public comment period, which is why we didn't actually include it. But it will, and we can make sure that you get copies forthwith.
Thank you.
But it has a lot of information in there about what we can do, both short-term actions and long-term actions that can be taken to help meet the goal. And it includes referencing things like what you're talking about.
I think the most interesting thing about your findings was that you found that your existing plans for other reasons actually met the reduction goal.
It just goes to show that when you do the right thing for the right reasons, the right consequences occur.
Thank you. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, having been involved in virtually all of the light rail lines in the Portland area, dating back 30 years, I can tell you that transit funding is a real problem, and it's more difficult in Oregon than in many of the other urban regions around because of a couple of things. One is we have a dedicated highway fund since about 1980. Those funds cannot be used for transit. Secondarily, we have no sales tax in Oregon, whereas most states, if they want to build a major project, either highway or transit, all they have to do is add a half a penny on a sales tax, and boom, there's a boatload of money. So what we've had to do, I was especially involved as Chair of JPAC when we were planning for and building the Green Line, which goes near my home and through my district. What we had to do is piece together little pots of money from several different sources to make up the approximately 50% match that you have to have. The federal government generally, they used to would fund 60%, now it's closer to 50% of these projects. And so what we did when we were putting together the Green Line, for example, we got a payment from Portland State because it terminates in Portland State or did. It's going to extend now. We got money from City of Portland. We certainly got money from Metro. We got money from Multnomah County. We got money from Clackamas County, yes, a bit. So a bunch of different jurisdictions each contributed, you know, 20, 25 million, whatever, toward the half billion that we had to raise, and we were able to do it. It's really remarkable what we've accomplished, given the constraints of funding in this state. And it's, you know, it means that we're going to have to continue to look at how we can fund transit infrastructure as well as highway infrastructure, all of which is needed if we're going to meet the goals outlined by Commissioner Dirks and others.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would agree with everything Senator Monroe said, but one caveat comes to mind, and that is users. You know, I think we do a really poor job of collecting from the people that actually use the rail. And, you know, this voluntary payment scheme that's going on, and I just feel very strongly that if you're going to use light rail, then you need to pay your fair share to use it. And I think that we've done a poor job collecting, and I think that's one source. I didn't really see too much about, but I do think collection is something that we need to look at.
If I may respond to that, I'm in total agreement, and I've addressed that with TriMet myself. In the last year or so, TriMet has actually improved their fare collection by having a lot more fare inspectors on the trains and checking people and make sure that they've paid. I think in the long term, in the future, we need to look toward making the rail system a more closed system, as you see in other cities, where you actually have to have paid to go through a turnstile before you can get on the. There's going to be places where that's a real challenge, but as we look to the future and we look at improvements to the system, I think there are places where we can do that, and we should do that as we can to assure that we get that kind of fair collection.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. I just to address that issue, and I agree with Councilor Dirksen, but I would have to say, as someone who rides light rail fairly often, not regularly, but particularly out to the airport, I'll tell you that TriMet has done a significantly better job of fare enforcement. Lots of times I've gotten come up to a station, and as the doors open, every door comes on a fare enforcement officer or a local law enforcement officer that's contracted with TriMet to check fares, and it's way better than it's ever been. And again, my wife rides the light rail from Hillsborough into Portland on a regular basis, and you know she's reporting the same kind of activity. So TriMet's done a lot better job of fare enforcement.
That system also has the added benefit of actually improving security on the trains as well.
Yeah. I would note that that's similar to my experience in other cities where I've ridden the light rail. When you know there's going to be someone there checking, I suspect that people choose to buy the fare. I always do. I think Senator Monroe has really got to the problem of it's our system is very hard to fund transit. Yeah. I just noted that. I know there's a lot of smart people who have been trying to figure out how to do this, and there seems to be very few suggestions given our constitutional blockage of views of that. One of the things that I've suggested is if you look at most of the transit systems, the largest outside of federal and state funds, the largest source seems to be payroll tax on businesses. And if you consider that transit largely is a social good, I've often wondered why we don't have a corresponding tax on payroll tax on individuals, much like we have workers' comp and other things like that. It's one possibility. The light rail thing is wonderful in the metro area, the way it works there. I know there's lots of discussion about that, and there are many people who don't like it. I happen to like it a lot when I'm up in the Portland area and use it. I think it works very well there and seems to be doing better. My understanding is that the usage is far above what the projections were for it at this time. Our experience in Lane County on bus rapid transit, frankly, worked out much better than I would have thought that it was going to work. People seem to like that. They use it a lot, and as I understand it from LTD, the cost is actually much cheaper than the old system of running buses. And you do have, I know a lot of people argue that there's the flexibility because you don't have fixed rails. It's certainly cheaper to install, but I don't think it's as flexible as people think that it is once you see all the capital improvement that you put in to get it there. And it's not any less controversial.
Once you build a freeway, it's never very flexible either. Appreciate your comments. Yeah, there's definitely challenges and there's misconceptions. One of the things that's important, and I know Senator Starr brought up the question about transit operations, and one of the things we've learned in the study when we've been working on the Southwest Corridor Plan, which I'm the co-chair of that focus group, is that the actual cost per ride for transit for rail is about 50%, about little more than half the cost of a cost per ride on buses because of the operating costs of buses. Mm-hmm. So while a rail line has significantly higher capital costs, one-time cost up front, the year-to-year costs that come out of payroll taxes are significantly reduced by having that kind of a system instead of having to run buses with a diesel electric or diesel engines.
Brother, anything else? Thank you very much.
Appreciated
the update. All right. So the next one up, we're going to talk about brownfields. Patrick, any introductory?
Oh, no, sir. I believe all our panelists are here.
Come on down. We've got a panel of four. John, are you leading off?
Morning. Excuse me. I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here representing a quite a large and diverse group that's been looking at the issue of brownfields. That's included cities, mayors, local governments, businesses, law firms, various groups like Thousand Friends, and getting together to talk about how we can make progress on brownfields. And a brownfield is a piece of property that, because of contamination or perceived contamination, and is lying unused. And what they are not are things like Superfund sites or sites where there has been a discharge or release and there is a responsible party and it's being cleaned up by the DEQ. Typical brownfields could be things like abandoned gas stations, dry cleaners, maybe some metal works where the property was contaminated. And because of the costs of cleanup or the perceived liabilities, it's just sitting. And often these are kind of a blight on the landscape because, for one thing, is they're not paying any significant property taxes. They tend to drag down the value of the property around them. And, of course, they don't employ anybody. And there are some programs that deal with brownfields and kind of recuperating brownfields. And if you think about brownfields and kind of put them into three groups, there's one group of brownfields that, because the property is in such a good location, or maybe it costs so little to clean up, that it's going to get cleaned up regardless. You know, a company will come in, they'll buy it, they'll take the liability, they'll do the cleanup. We don't need to worry about those. And maybe it's done under an existing program. So that's one group. And then there's a second group which, because of the contamination and the value of the property, and maybe it's not located anywhere near other businesses or whatever, it's simply not, there's no interest in cleaning it up regardless of what the program would be. And so those kind of fall into the, you know, the far other side group of brownfields that are not going to get cleaned up. And then you have these ones that are in the middle, kind of tipping point, that could get cleaned up if the right incentives were there. They're kind of the unaffiliated group of brownfields. You know, they're not one or the other, but they fall in the middle. There are a lot of them. There are about 13,500, and I think you have a sheet. You should have this sheet in front of you. And if you look at it, you can see there are dots where there are brownfields located. And a lot of these dots lie on top of other dots. So there are a lot around. And a lot of times you don't know they're there. You just drive by them, and it's a parcel of property that never gets developed. They're urban and rural. They're all over the state. About 35% of them have had some work on them or some assessment. A lot of them are in economically distressed areas. So the goal of this group was to look at other mechanisms that could spur the development or redevelopment of existing brownfields at minimal cost to the state and with local government control, just whatever is out there that looks creative that can be done. And there have been lots of studies that have been done around the country, and in some cases the incentives are too loose, in some places too tight, and they're highly varied. But this group did a really good job on surveying what's being done around the country, I think. And what we're kind of talking to you today is about some ideas that we're looking at that we may bring to you during the session. And so none of these have been really analyzed in depth or fleshed out, but they're things that you're likely to see, or at least we'll be talking about. One of them is recapitalization of the Brownfields Development Fund, and we have sent a letter to the governor asking that that fund be recapitalized. It's run by Business Oregon. And it is a program of grants and loans run by Business Oregon that helps people that are interested in recuperating a brownfield either get it done through a grant, especially if it's a municipality, or a loan process that might get that brownfield back into play, back into development, and have people hiring. The fund, which originally had, I think, about $12 million in it, is down almost empty. I think it's down to $150,000, which does not clean up much. We're looking at some other kind of innovative ideas that are being used around the country. One is a land bank, and that would be formation of a body that would authorize cities or ports to acquire contaminated property and manage it and sell it and get it developed. Looking at the possibility of local tax abatements, that's another one that's a possibility. We're looking at possibility of brownfields tax credit at the state level if you recover your brownfield. We'll be very careful what we name it, even though it starts with a B. It won't be a Betsy. We'll call it something else. We're looking at possibility of regulatory streamlining. These are all being kind of fleshed out now, and I expect what you will see in the next session are a couple of fairly solid proposals, and then perhaps a couple of proposals that just need further study, just because they're complicated, and we need to see what was done in other states. The trick here, I think, is to make it, construct this so it's minimal cost, optional, leaves a lot of local control, and also is not available to people that are going to redevelop the field anyway. Those really, they shouldn't have access to this. And you want it to be able to fund as much money into those ones that might tip into the development side. And so it's almost like a means testing kind of mechanism, and we really haven't figured out how to do that. The other thing that I think will be a challenge is what else gets hooked on to the redevelopment or the brownfields recuperation. And one of the interesting things about this is everybody wants the brownfields to be redeveloped, and then everybody also has secondary issues that they'd like it to be redeveloped into, like, you know, maybe not this kind of a store, but that kind of a store, or if it's going to redevelop, it has to be affordable housing. I mean, everybody has an interest in this, and it's going to take some time, I think, to sort through that. But the idea is you have thousands of these things out there, and they're kind of a blight on the community. And we need to find a way that won't clean them all up, but it's another mechanism to get it going in the right direction. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jason Miner, Executive Director of 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thanks for hearing testimony on brownfields today. We are a land use policy advocacy organization. We represent several thousand members around the state, and we're a proud member of this brownfields coalition that John just outlined and others will talk to you about this morning. We come to this coalition because I believe that at least two kinds of land exist in our communities, and those are greenfields. Those are greenfields and brownfields. Greenfields are areas that are a community asset. They're contributing to the economy through agriculture, forestry, and other uses that create jobs and revenue. And on the other hand, we have brownfields, lands that are a community liability. These lands detract from our communities in several ways, and I just wanted to speak on behalf of 1000 Friends and how we see these lands detracting from our communities and why we think it's so important to make a policy choice to invest in cleaning them up. First, they limit the ability to create jobs in existing industrial areas and even on main streets in some of our rural areas. As John mentioned, these can be things as seemingly unsuspecting as a old gas station site or an old dry cleaner. Sometimes it's just the suspicion of contamination that leads them to be undeveloped. They can be mill sites, construction sites, or other manufacturing sites. So it's an issue that is present in both urban and rural Oregon. They impact the livability of communities, leaving vital sites vacant in their very cores. Again, sometimes right on a downtown main street, you'll have a brownfield site that leaves a gap in our communities. They limit our ability to use land efficiently. Often these sites are already served with utilities and transportation infrastructure, the kinds of things that we were talking about just this morning with the Climate Smart Communities conversation, the things that we'll be talking about in transportation funding options or transportation funding package this session. These are sites that often we've already made the community investment in with public dollars to put sewer, road, water, sidewalk, those kinds of pieces of infrastructure to areas that are now currently surrounding the brownfield, essentially. But the brownfield site already benefits from some of those, and believe fundamentally that the most efficient use of our the public dollars we have already spent on infrastructure is to look into ways to invest in restoring brownfields to a potential development status. And, of course, these sites are brownfields because they suffer from environmental contamination. That contamination can directly affect the health of neighbors, impacting air and water quality in ways that directly harm some of the most vulnerable Oregonians, those who often live next to brownfield sites, either knowingly or unknowingly. And finally, our failure to use land in our urban and rural centers puts pressure for housing and development on greenfields, lands outside our developed centers, land that is more difficult and in many cases more expensive to serve than redevelopment of our existing brownfield sites. In closing, we support the work of the coalition, and I encourage you to look into funding the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund, as John had mentioned, as well as expanding the toolbox. I'm particularly interested in industrial land banking, an area that this committee or this coalition is looking into to make it proven effective in other jurisdictions in the Midwest. Cleveland, in particular, has an industrial land bank. I am interested in exploring further opportunities with the coalition. I think we've brought together a really diverse group. As John mentioned, we represent local governments, nonprofits, business associations, the Port of Portland, and I think that the diversity of this coalition reflects the broad recognition that we can do more with undeveloped or underdeveloped and harmful brownfield sites in our community centers. And I also want to point out that these, as John mentioned, we all come to this with our own interests, and there will be a lot of conversation about what these sites get developed into, but there are a tremendous number of opportunities for what they can become. They can become employment centers, they can become parks, they can become affordable housing, they can become market rate housing. But the real problem is that currently they sit as brownfields. And I encourage you to work with us to address that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. I'm John Miller. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network. Oregon Opportunity Network is a statewide association of affordable housing and community development associations. Our membership includes about 50 direct service organizations and over 100 industry partners. We own and operate over 25,000 homes in the state, and we serve about 75,000 low and moderate income Oregonians. Our members do more than just build and own properties. Through their work, they strengthen and build communities. That's really what they're striving to do. And they often choose to work in distressed areas. And what we found over the years is that in these distressed areas, there's a lot of brownfields. And oftentimes, the brownfields sit in the middle of what they're trying to recreate. And they really slow down progress. And when a brownfield is in the midst of a community in transition, it acts as an anchor, sort of keeping it down and not allowing it to really realize its full potential. And what we found, well, the opportunity costs are really significant to not deal with these brownfields. And they really hurt the ability of communities to bring themselves up. And, you know, one of the things that we really see is having affordable housing as a piece of any kind of transitioning community. So there are many problems with these sites, and perhaps the greatest challenge is a lack of funding to clean them up and also a lack of will. Often the owners don't have the resources to do the remediation necessary to bring these sites back into productive use, and so they sit vacant, as we've heard. But we also see that these are rich with opportunity. They're often, as I mentioned, they're in areas of transition, in neighborhoods where neighbors are working to build a better community and better lives. Sometimes these sites are located in areas that are experiencing gentrification and rapid redevelopment, such as Portland's Pearl District or South Waterfront. I mean, areas with significant public investment, such as these, it's important that our outcome, one of the outcomes, is affordable housing. And we really see affordable housing as a central infrastructure to any healthy community. So by cleaning up these sites and building affordable housing on them, communities transform unhealthy eyesores into community assets. And I just wanted to give you a couple of examples that our members have done. Right in downtown Eugene is the Aurora building. The Aurora building was built on an abandoned gas station site. It was the first affordable housing that was built in downtown Eugene in 20 years. And a lot of folks felt that it would never fly, that you don't want to put affordable housing right in the downtown core of Eugene. And that's why it didn't happen for 20 years. Well, they cleaned up the site, they built the affordable housing, and it's leased up within a month. And what followed from that redeveloped site was several other projects. And now downtown Eugene actually has a vibrant residential element, whereas before it didn't. So it was really the cleanup of that site was really, really proved to be a catalyst to that change. Another one that I wanted to tell you about is the Watershed, which is a development by Community Partners of Affordable Housing out in Washington County. It's located at Bertha Boulevard and Capitol Highway, right at the intersection of those two roads. And that site is really, it's right in the core of the Hillsdale Town Center. And for many years, it sat, had a whole bunch of different uses. It was a train stop for a while. It was an auto wrecking and refueling site for a while. And then most recently, it was used for newspaper storage and sanitation truck storage. And this was right in the core of the downtown. The site was not getting cleaned up. Finally, it did get cleaned up through a brownfield grant. And now, when you drive through there, you see a beautiful building. It's SEPA's building. It says Hillsdale going up and down. If you've been through there, you've probably seen it. It really anchors the community. And so we see results like this over and over again throughout the state. And this has been a great program, particularly for affordable housing. But, you know, as has been mentioned, there's a bunch of different uses. We think affordable housing is one really good use for this program. But, you know, there's other outcomes that are equally as important. So I'm not here advocating that they have to be affordable housing, but I am letting you know that they, by cleaning up brownfields, you really do see significant community transition. Thank you so much.
Chair Beyer, Senators, thank you for having me here today. My name is Miranda Bateshell, and I work at Metro, but I am actually here not representing necessarily Metro or the work that we've done around brownfields, but I'm really here to talk today about our role with the Brownfields Coalition. We're acting as the facilitator convener of this large group and reaching out statewide, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we have heard when we've been working with the different members of the coalition and with people around the state. We reached out, and unfortunately those folks couldn't make it here today, but I just want to give you a sense of some of the things we've heard at the site level that are challenging and how what we're looking at through this Brownfields Coalition and expanding the toolbox for Brownfields redevelopment, how that could actually help those sites immediately or make those projects better or easier or faster. One of the contacts that we've made is out in Lincoln City, working with their urban renewal department and agency staff. And they really talked about how that project took them a decade, has been taking them a decade just to get to clean up. So for 10 years now, they've been spending the time just to get the site cleaned up and haven't actually been able to bring that back into a community asset, into jobs or housing or a local community center, that they've really had to spend that much time just being able to get the funding to get the cleanup happening. But the only way they've been able to do that is because they have urban renewal and tax increment financing. And that's the only financial assistance they've been able to have. And so a lot of these sites you'll see will happen in urban renewal areas, but the majority of the state and the majority of our communities aren't within urban renewal areas, and the brownfields that sit within those areas don't have access to financial tools to help offset the cost of cleanup. Another example that we've been running into, one of the members of the coalition is involved in sort of outer southeast Portland, working in that community, and there's an old dry cleaner that's at about 164th and Division. And one of the things with that site is they really want to turn that into some type of community asset. It's very centrally located. It's where the community wants to see a lot going on. They've identified it as a place where they want to see redevelopment. But there's really no tools for them to do that. And again, the city of Portland's response has been, well, it's not within an urban renewal area, and we don't have the capacity to or the resources to acquire that property or to help you acquire that property in the meantime. And so one of the things we're looking at is a land bank. And as Jason mentioned, it could be used as an industrial land bank, and other opportunities to actually set up land banks for community land banks. And so in this case, that could be a tool that would help them to acquire the site and allow them the time to get the partners together to actually fund a redevelopment project on that site and see the type of asset that they want to see.
How would that be funded?
So the idea here is that we would allow land banks to occur, and then the entity itself would be able to, whether it's the city or another organization, would determine whatever seed funding that they need to have to start it. So it could be general funding that starts the initial pot of money. And then within within these land bank examples, typically what we see is that a percentage, once the land is returned and sold and improved upon, that a percentage of the tax revenue in the first 5 years goes back to the land bank. And so that helps to then provide, to basically refund them for the investment that they've made and provide additional funding for ongoing investments in additional properties.
So is there something that precludes cities probably from doing that now?
Yes. And part of it is because it sets up a structure for them to be able to become a separate entity. Currently, they can take on, you know, local governments can buy whatever land they want. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they purchase it, they can purchase it and acquire it. This provides different structures for them to be able to have liability releases associated with the brownfields. It creates financial incentives. It creates a separate entity. In the same way you have, like, urban renewal and you have an urban renewal board because you have tax increment financing authority, this is similar, but it creates kind of like a nonprofit corporation, like a C corporation, that has the ability to fund development and take on additional controls that a local government wouldn't have. Hmm. So a couple other examples, and then I'll open it up for questions. One more that we wanted to highlight was in the city of Newport. They have their international terminal, and that was actually a project we've, as a coalition, we've said, all three of us so far have said, and I will reiterate, that one of our priorities is the recapitalization of the Oregon Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. That project that has brought a lot of jobs was half funded. It was a $3.6 million project, and half of it was funded by the Oregon Brownfields Fund. And so without that, that project wouldn't have happened, and that's a fund that's very important and integral to a number of the projects around the state, and that's something we continue to hear every time we reach out and talk to people. And then the last project I want to highlight is actually Ava Roasteria, which I believe is in this packet that you'll see. It's an example of a private development. The other three that I've listed have all been publicly funded or publicly initiated, and that's because these are highly difficult. The risk involved with these sites and the costs involved with these sites are often too much for a private developer to take on, and this is another example of that, and that the only reason that really happened and has turned into an amazing community asset for the city of Beaverton in their downtown is that this person was committed to this project from the beginning, no matter what. But even that being said, faced significant financial burden, not just for the cleanup costs, but because as soon as you improve the site with improved values, you also have higher taxes. But cleanup costs are often ongoing. Sometimes you have monitoring that lasts 5 years. And so you're having to, you've decided to improve the site. Now that creates a more financial burden for you, not just for the cleanup, but because you've improved the site. And so we're just looking at tools that help to offset that, at least during the time of cleanup, so that that cleanup cost is acknowledged as an important improvement for the environmental and health standpoint of the community, as well as for the redevelopment. So we're just looking to try to balance the situation. We're looking at a broad list of tools, as John mentioned, and we're just trying to make these brownfield sites easier to turn into any community asset, as we've all said, whether they're jobs, green spaces, affordable housing, and make them an economic return both to the local government as well as to the state, because right now we're losing out on them. And our coalition, the Brownfields Coalition, we look forward to working together with you to get that done in the near future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. A couple of questions. One, you mentioned that you've done a lot of research across the nation, looking for best practices, things that are working. Have you put that in any written form that you could share?
There are two recent, Chair Beyer, there are two recent reports that were done, one by Metro, as well as one done by the City of Portland, because we've both been looking at this in terms of our buildable lands. And there are a number of tools that have been outlined. I know in the Metro one, there's about 18 to 20 different tools that were looked at, and similar with the City of Portland. And that's something that we can provide to you.
That'd be helpful if you would. Secondly, in terms of do either of those or if anything been done, it'd be interesting to know sort of the range of sizes of sites that are out there. I know there are a lot of former gas stations and dry cleaners. I've worked with a number of those. Very hard to do because of their small size and you just can't turn it. But I wonder in terms of the industrial acreage, you mentioned that. I'm particularly interested in that.
So, Chair Beyer, we did look at that in the Metro study region-wide. Because of our land use data, it was easier to quantify that type of information. And we do have a broad range. We see a lot more number of sites in the small acreage, anywhere from a tenth to a quarter acre. But we do have a significant, the majority of the acreage is actually covered by our industrial areas because of the nature of those large sites. We are actually currently undergoing a study to see if we can try to better quantify that for you at the statewide level. You know, that's difficult to do because there isn't a standardized sort of land use data file. But we are trying to compile different sources of data in order to better understand what that looks like and what the ratio of large sites to small sites is across the whole state.
Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. And you may not have the answers right now, but just, you know, by the convening of session, it would be helpful to know a little bit more as we consider the recapitalization of the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. I'm just interested in knowing of the number of sites with that $12 million, of the number of sites that were that have been cleaned up. How many have been then turned in the market, you know, versus, you know, we're just building inventory, but a lot of those sites are still problematic and they're just sitting there in terms of development potential. So just kind of what's happening with the inventory of sites that we have spent money on to date. And then my follow-up question is, I just don't remember, and I should, but I don't, how that money is allocated. Does every county have a certain amount? Is it just direct to the state? And how that money is dispersed throughout the state? So you don't have to answer me right now, but just by next session, I'd be interested in that information.
So the fund goes through Business Oregon's Brownfield program, and it really is not necessarily allocated on a county-by-county basis. It's allocated by a project-by-project basis. So project applicants come in, and there's a threshold for which they need to prove that it's becoming a community asset, and it's partly based, too, on the amount of the funds available at the time.
Is it basically grants, or is it a combination of grants and loans?
It's a combination of grants and loans. The grants are, I believe, only for public and nonprofit entities. Private sector folks, development projects can get funding, but it's in a loan basis.
Pretty hard to get private funding to do a cleanup.
I might add, Metro has done a really good job researching this. It's been very helpful.
Other questions? How involved has DEQ been in this process?
Senator Chair, we have multiple representatives from DEQ that are part of the Brownfields Coalition, and they've been a great partner both through the Metro and City of Portland studies as well as through this process to try to identify solutions that really meet the needs of all of us at the table. So they're highly involved and been a great partner.
Right. I've been involved in a couple recently where they've just fallen over themselves to help out, and people are really surprised at how helpful and useful they were.
They have a program prospective purchaser agreement that's been highly successful and very amenable, which is why nobody hears about it, you know, because there's no conflict. But it's
never hear about what's working, only about what's not.
The unknown is the big problem with cleanup. I mean, the minute you take on one of these projects, it can be $10 or $10 million, and you don't know until you get into it. Have we looked into we are a legislative body, so it seems to me like gas tanks are a huge part of this, that we do a tax credit scheme or something to help out getting these tanks out of the ground, because the longer they sit in there, the higher the probability is you're going to have a long-term problem. So I just wonder, did that come up at all, that maybe we can do something? Because really, gas stations seem to be one of the pivotal points.
Yeah, there is a program that, unfortunately, it's called leaking underground storage tanks, which is LUST. And that has been pretty successful in pulling out tanks. But, of course, once something is released, then just pulling out the tank doesn't fix the whole problem. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, especially on these smaller operations, the smaller industrial operations, things that were done in the past that were acceptable simply aren't anymore. And the problem is this stuff hangs around. So you have places, it might have been a machine shop where they, over the years, stuff accumulated on the ground, or they used to pour stuff on the ground. I mean, that's what people used to do, and it just doesn't move much. And so any kind of activity like that, it doesn't take a lot to have a site that's contaminated, or people fear is contaminated, and they don't know where it's going to end. You're right.
Any other questions? Good report. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That's a good question. Next up, Paul, the Oregon Department project update.
I just wonder if
Did you have any info on this contract?
No, Mr. Chair, this is one of our standard ones. Are we having videos today?
Two?
Yes,
several.
We're continuing the trend of showing videos. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. I like the idea of tax credit.
Welcome, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, here to give you another update on the projects that have been going on this summer. Before, get organized here. Before I get going into the project updates, I thought it'd be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about funding and where transportation funding is. You've seen this chart before. This is our mountain chart, looking at some of the major programs you've funded over the last decade, the OTIA 3 and the JTA program, and just where we are kind of on the downslope of that. And our future is reliance on federal funding and the uncertainty that's been going on at the federal level in Congress. Trevor Sleeman is here with me today, and I thought he'd just give you a quick update on things that have transpired this summer in Congress and just what is ahead of us over the next several months as they wrestle with sustainability of a federally funded transportation program. So Trevor will give you a little background on that.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Trevor Sleeman, and I'm the Federal Affairs Advisor at the Oregon Department of Transportation, and have one slide to show with you share with you today. And this slide gives you a pretty broad overview of the challenges we're facing at the federal level as it relates to surface transportation funding. And certainly this picture would be bleaker were it not for the $10.8 billion Congress transferred into the Highway Trust Fund, $10.8 billion in general fund revenues, I should say, transferred into the Highway Trust Fund at the end of July. And that transfer, of course, was necessary because the Highway Trust Fund was drawn down more quickly than expected. Although highway funding was supposed to last through the end of the fiscal year, at the end of September, it was actually close to insolvency toward the end of July, and insolvency was projected for early August. So at the end of July, the transfer was made. As I said, $10.8 billion, and that transfer will keep the fund solvent through May of 2015, so we have a few months of breathing room, thanks to Congress. And you can see in the balance line there is a bit of a spike 2014 there, and that indicates the $10.8 billion transfer. You can also see just how insignificant that is in relation to the broader problems facing the Highway Trust Fund. So if you look at the blue bars, that is the revenues going into the Highway Trust Fund. That's all the federal gas tax revenues going into the fund. And you can see that the balance, the revenues going into the fund over the years varies based on different factors. But the important takeaway is, if you look at the future projection, the Congressional Budget Office is projecting those revenues to be flat for the next several years. So if those revenues do indeed stay flat, and if expenditures, the gray line there, continue on their recent trend lines, you can see a pretty wide gap opens up there and doesn't even come close to closing. And so that's about a $15 billion gap every year into the future. Pretty significant shortfall. And just to present a sort of worst case scenario, if Congress were to decide it fiscally prudent to limit expenditures from the fund to revenues coming into the fund, that would be that $15 billion would be about a 30% cut in the federal surface transportation spending program. So here in Oregon, a 30% cut to the federal share is about $140 million. I don't want to bear only bad news today. There is some good news. If you look at the orange bars, over the years, in recent years rather, as there's been expenditures and revenues haven't matched up, Congress has stepped in several times, as you can see, to backfill the fund with general fund revenues. So there is bipartisan agreement in Congress that funding surface transportation is important, and they have gone to extraordinary means to do so. But the uncertainty created by waiting on that general fund appropriation every year, it does make it difficult to plan and carry out long-term projects. And just like here at the state level, any increase in gas tax, for example, can become negated by increasing fuel efficiency and all those other factors. So in an ideal world, Congress would tackle those problems by authorizing a long-term, multi-year extension of surface transportation policy and funding. But at this point, I think it's very unlikely that we see a long-term reauthorization for a number of reasons relating to political context. And I think whatever ultimately happens, the next action in Congress as the money runs out again in May is another short-term extension of current policy. So I think flat funding is likely here to stay. And the real question is how long the extensions will last. Before the current authorization, MAP 21, was passed 2 years ago, the prior authorization, Safe T-Lou, was extended 11 times, sometimes for as short as 1 week. So I think that, unfortunately, for everyone in the room, that flat funding and uncertainty at the federal level is likely to continue for several more months.
Curiosity question, the out years there, the flat funding, is that a balancing of increased fuel efficiency offsetting marginal increase in purchases?
Yeah, and actually I saw recently that nationally vehicle miles traveled are increasing in the last couple of years, but any increase in miles driven is being offset by fuel efficiency gains.
Mr. Chair, it's one of those issues of competing values, in which we have the value of the Congress increasing the mandated CAFE standards and the value of creating the dollars to fund our transportation system. A little bit of a conflict there.
There's a little bit. Right. And in fact, that orange bar there, where they got the money, is a little bit illusionary, too.
Yeah. There's no question.
Good. So I'll go through several projects here. I'm going to take a little different tack than I've taken in other updates, cover a few different projects maybe you haven't seen before. Starting with the Iowa Street Viaduct on I-5, many of you, if probably not all of you, have driven by this over the last 3 years as we've replaced this viaduct, a $45 million project on I-5, one of the busiest stretches that we have in the state, very difficult construction area to work on, a very steep slope, very high traffic volumes. Most of the work was done at night. As you drove by, you probably rarely saw work actually going on during the day, but much of the work happening at night. Wildish was the contractor on the project, did an excellent job. In fact, they came up with some very innovative ways to set the beams as they had that temporary construction happening at night. But we're in the final stretch of this project, wrapping it up, doing the final work on the retaining wall that you saw, holding the slope back, and it's going to turn out to be a great project. But as an example of a project and needs we have in the system, oftentimes as you drive down that stretch in I-5 before this project, you probably didn't even know the bridge was even there. And it required a $45 million project to replace a bridge most people didn't even know was there. And so it's an example of an asset we've got to take care of, very expensive asset. We do under traffic, very difficult construction area. But it's an example of the immense
this
need we have
in the
system.
This is just south of the curves?
It is. Yep. Yep. The next project I was going to touch on is one that was mentioned in a previous presentation, is the project we have we call Oregon ODOT Real Time. It has to do with providing motorists better information on, so they can make better choices on the Portland freeway system, but also to improve safety and give them information about upcoming traffic slowdowns ahead of them. So I have just a short video.
We all want to get where we're going safely, with fewer delays and less worry. Now there are some new signs on the road that will help us do just that, by giving drivers real-time information about traffic conditions. It's called ODOT Real Time, and it's being phased in on highways around Portland. Here's what to look for. First, we've added travel time to many of the digital signs in the Portland area. In addition to crash messages or road conditions, these signs will now tell you how long it will take to reach various points up ahead. This up-to-the-second information can help you plan your arrival time or even take an alternate route. Another kind of real-time sign will display advisory speeds. You'll see these along the I-5, I-405 southbound interchange. Let's say you're driving south on I-5. Traffic ahead is backed up, but because the roadway curves, you can't always see it until it's too late. That can lead to rear-end crashes, injury, and greater congestion. The advisory speed signs will help prevent that by giving you a heads up to slow down before you reach the problem. When traffic is heavy, they'll advise slower speeds. When it starts to ease up, they'll show higher advisory speeds. And when traffic is moving smoothly, the signs will be off. You'll also see new signs along Highway 217. These signs will display travel times, advisory speeds, and other information. All in all, the new signs will help manage the area's traffic and give motorists the ability to make travel decisions in real time. By changing as traffic conditions change, they'll help everyone get where they're going safely and efficiently. So look for ODOT Real Time signs on highways around Portland. ODOT Real Time, know as you go.
Paul, how are the changes in those signs managed?
They're managed, Senator Beyer, they're managed through our incident command center in our region office in downtown Portland. We have a center down there that monitors all the cameras that we have throughout the Portland metro area and make adjustments kind of in real time to the speed signs as well as other incidents that we see on the roadways, calling our incident responders to go out there and deal with the incident, provide emergency responders, whether it's fire or police, also to be responding out there to the incident. So we have a command center already set up that this utilizes.
So it's manual inputs.
Well, they monitor it, but this it's a highly automated system. And that's one of our challenges that we had with the system is that we over the years we've added different variable message signs, we've added different ramp meters, we've added different technology, and just as you've seen in your PC over those years, you've seen technology change dramatically. And so now we're trying to knit all those together without reinvesting or replacing all those. We're trying to knit all those together in a way that they work together. And it's been extremely challenging in different eras of technology and putting those together. So it took us a lot of work that we want to do behind the scenes and actually ran this for several months kind of in our office before we saw it out there live to get a feel for how this was going to work before we turned it on. And we're still making fine-tuning some of the things with the system. But it's working very well, and we're getting good feedback, especially on the travel information signs. People are finding those very useful.
Good. Senator Starr?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the challenges, perhaps, is to provide enough warning for drivers so they have options.
Right.
I'll just give you one example that happened to me, where all of a sudden we're on I-4 heading east, and there's a sign that says freeway closed.
Hmm.
Is when they had that active shooter situation, and you close the entire freeway. By the time I saw that sign, my options were very, very limited. I didn't have the option. I was already on 84 heading east. All of the exit ramps were crowded, obviously, as folks were trying to adjust their travel. And I don't know if perhaps in that situation I'd missed one before I made the choice to go east on 84 off of I-5. But talk a little bit about how the system works in that regard.
Chair Byer, Senator Starr, so a couple of comments. It's hard to tell just where you were when the incident happened. So we get notification the freeway is closed. We start the notification process. You might have been right, a few seconds before we turn that sign on. Mm-hmm. Depends on where you were caught. We also have limitations on just where our signs are now. We have a fairly limited amount, even though we expanded this project. There's still a fairly limited amount of technologies that we have. Just in the last few weeks, we actually received a Tiger Grant to actually improve this system even more, especially focused on Washington County. We're going to take this system more to the arterial system as well as the freeway system throughout Portland. I-4 is one of those areas we're going to see more of this technology in the next phase through the Tiger Grant be implemented. So we'll have more tools available to inform drivers ahead of time.
Mr. Chair, just one additional, I guess, issue that occurs regularly on I-5 north or south, depending on which way you're coming, and that's a bridge lift. It'd be helpful to drivers, I know, if they were given as much warning on bridge lifts as possible. I'm assuming that's part of your system.
Right. That's correct.
Senator?
No, thank you, Chair Barr. The suggested speed, this is a real quick question, it really has no legal standing, though, does it?
Senator Byers, Senator Jordan, we debated about that a lot. Certain states do that very different. In our research for this project, we did a lot of outreach to other states that have a similar system. Seattle has been utilizing this for a number of years. And there's a mixture out there of advisory speeds as well as regulatory speeds. We decided to go with just advisory speeds and advise people rather than get into the details and specifics of a regulatory speed. But it has the capability, those signs can change color. And so if we wanted to go through sometime in the future and found that regulatory signs was a better way to go, we have the ability to do that. But we're going to start with advisory signs before we get too far down the road.
Thanks, Paul. Go ahead.
Another project we continue to work on is the Pioneer Mountain Eddyville project.
It moves
through its new phase. Actually continues to move along well. This just gives you a little bit of perspective of the project. There's an aerial photograph taking of really just a slice of the project. You're a long ways from seeing either end of the project with this, but to give you a little bit of appreciation for the size and scope of this project. Again, I got just a short video. I think it does the best to help you see exactly what we're doing and the amount of work that's happening.
Phase 3 of the US 20 project began construction in May on the unfinished segment of a new 5.5-mile section of highway that will bypass 10 miles of current US 20, twisting and turning west of Eddyville. The new alignment cuts through the Oregon Coast Range, home to active landslides. And this 2-year phase of construction is all about reducing the slide movement along the new roadway while continuing to monitor hundreds of instruments collecting ground data. By August, approximately 80 workers and more than 50 pieces of heavy equipment were ramped up, moving 100,000 cubic yards of earth per week to fill the valleys of 4 major drainages along the project, where plans for bridges had been scrapped due to continued landslide activity. Lowering the roadway elevation by 20 feet also eliminates weight that can affect slide activity. Tests are conducted once or twice a week, creating 5,000 to 10,000 cubic yards of rubble, contributing substantially to the 500,000 cubic yards of earth and rock placed so far this season, and the 2.4 million cubic yards of earth to be moved during the entire 2-year phase. At the bottom of Eddy C, the fill is spread and compacted, building the embankment that will both buttress a landslide and provide the base of the new highway's final alignment. At the end of this first season, the embankment will be as high as that pink ribbon, some 260 to 280 feet, slightly more than half of its 320-foot elevation at completion. During the winter, ground monitoring sensors will tell engineers how the landslide beneath is responding to the weight of the embankments at all four creeks, giving them knowledge that will fine-tune the project's final design. It's part of the project's observational approach. It's an early warning system with data that helps engineers pinpoint where and how to address slide movement. Such observation recently alerted engineers to the need to design an expanded buttress at Crystal Creek. After the data indicated new movement below an embankment, engineers moved quickly to adjust the project design and include the changes to the work currently underway. The system allows the project to take the development in stride with no impact on the completion date. The US 20 project's Phase 3 construction will use all the tools available to mitigate landslides, removing weight by lowering the roadway, buttressing the landslides with rock and ground anchors, and relieving water pressure that triggers slide activity by installing another 20 miles of horizontal drains, adding to the horizontal drains, trench drains, and blanket drains from earlier phases of construction. By continuing its observational approach to data and design, the project stays nimble, ready to act quickly, and flexible, ready to modify designs to keep the project on budget and on track for traffic in 2016.
So how many miles of pipe have we got on that thing now?
Many. It's a very astonishing project in the scale that it is, the amount of dirt and amount of pipes that we have. If any of you are interested, I'd be glad to give you a tour of the project. We're actually going to go out on Friday and take a tour of the project. It's a very impressive project, and it's something we don't experience here in Oregon, just the scale of this, the project and the work that's going on. So if you're ever interested, I'd be glad to take you out there and show you the work that's going on. We're in a very short window. As I said before, we have about 100 days every year that we actually work on that project. So we're rapidly ending that 100 days that we have for this season. The contractors are already starting to work to kind of button things up for the wintertime. Our goal this season is to do about half of the fill work. Next season, we'll do the other half of the fill work. And then in 2016, we'll do the paving work and hopefully have a ribbon cutting ceremony after that was the plan. So we're still on track for all that. Budget-wise, we're looking good. Schedule-wise, we're looking good. But we'll see, as we said in the video, we'll see as we monitor those instruments over the wintertime and how those slides react to all the work that we've done this summer. Another project that's presented some challenges for us is the repaving of I-5 south of Eugene or south of Cottage Grove near the Douglas Lane County line. This is a section of concrete pavement that we're taking the concrete pavement out and doing some very extensive dig downs in areas of springs and others that we've got to do some extensive work. And so we've had to, this spring, limit traffic to a single lane through this section. During the Memorial Day weekend, we got stuck in a situation in that single lane where we had some pretty horrific backups for traffic coming back on Memorial Day weekend. We had to make some adjustments with the contractor to get this from a single lane back to four lanes for the 4th of July weekend. We were successful in that through the summer. On the balance of the summer, did not have any issues. But now, since Labor Day has passed, we're back to our single lane configuration. I'm happy to report the last couple weekends. I haven't got the report from last night, but Sunday nights has been where our problem areas has been. We've been doing well on our weekends to keep traffic moving through here. But this is a big project. Oregon Main Line is a contractor, and they've been great to work with to help us kind of adjust to what we're experiencing kind of real time out there with traffic and make adjustments to limit the impact to traffic. Another project I haven't talked much about, but this is a jobs and transportation project in rural Oregon. It's on Highway 42, right at the Coos-Douglas County line between Roseburg and Coos Bay. It's about a $10 million project to straighten out kind of the last section of that highway to make some improvements. You see a picture here where straightening out some pretty severe curves and providing better access between I-5 and Coos Bay. This project we were hopeful we were able to do in a season, but I think, again, like the Coast Range often is, we found a couple landslides we didn't know about. We've had to make some adjustments, but we'll be making those, and the construction will continue into next year, but it looks like the project overall will be a very successful project. Another project I've talked about is the Fern Valley Interchange in southern Oregon. It's just south of Medford. I've talked about the unique design that we have for this project. This is a $70 million Jobs and Transportation Act project. It's going very well. It has a lot of traffic impacts as we build this new interchange on the community, but we're working through those well with the community. What I thought I'd do today is just show you a little bit of how this interchange is going to operate. This is a very different interchange than we have anywhere in Oregon, anywhere on the West Coast. These are called the Virgin Diamond interchanges. You'll see a few of them pop up around the country, but this will be the first one on the West Coast and first one in Oregon. So I'll just give you a quick demonstration on how that's going to work.
Just south of Medford on Interstate 5, Exit 24 at Phoenix is an interchange in transition. Exit 24 is home to a growing interstate commercial area for the Rogue Valley and is the gateway to the city of Phoenix. To increase safety, reduce congestion, and keep people on the move, a new type of interchange called a diverging diamond will be constructed. This type of interchange is different because drivers move to the left side of the road to cross the overpass. The diverging diamond is used successfully in other parts of the country, and this one will be a first for Oregon and the West Coast. Its crossing movements make it safer and easier for drivers than a standard diamond interchange, and it has a smaller footprint. It has only two sets of signals on each side of the interchange. That means less time waiting in traffic. And there's no waiting for oncoming traffic to make a left turn. It's simply eliminated from the design. Let's see how the new interchange drives. As we approach the interchange from Phoenix, drivers will see many visual aids to help negotiate the area. That includes bicyclists and pedestrians who will also be able to cross the interchange safely and quickly. Note how northbound I-5 traffic makes a left prior to the signal before merging onto the interstate, and through traffic continues back to the right side of the road. This new interchange, as well as the new and modified roadways, will make it easier and convenient for travel to all areas of Phoenix on both sides of Exit 24. The new Interstate 5 Phoenix interchange will move traffic efficiently for the future. When complete, drivers will experience how this new interchange will improve traffic flow, enhance safety and livability for Phoenix and the entire Southern Rogue Valley.
Yeah, the design is a very efficient design. As I said, a very small footprint, but it offers a high-capacity interchange in a very small area. And in the right situations, works extremely well. We've seen examples around the country that we've gone and toured and talked to people about how to get the information out to educate drivers, because obviously as you move through this, it's going to be something that you're not used to experiencing. So we've produced videos like this and other avenues to communicate with the public about how to get used to driving through this.
I got a question, Mike.
Senator.
This diamond approach has got me, I think it's really, it looks rather obvious. I don't know why we didn't think of that earlier, but thinking through it, you got two traffic lights. Is there any way that you could alter the elevation so that one would go over the other one in that, in the span? I'm not saying for this project, I'm just saying for future projects where you wouldn't have to even have the traffic lights.
Senator Beyer, Senator Gerard, well, as an engineer, anything's possible. We can design it and make it work. But from a more practical point, how the geometrics of that intersection work, and having that ramp terminal come in the way it does, essentially every. Well, let me back up. So, as a traffic engineer, one of the things you try to do is do right turns. Right turns are easy. to do more efficient for everybody. And in this design, what happens is by crossing the traffic over, your left turns act as right turns for every movement that you saw in the interchange. You saw in the one video, the left turn actually acted as a right turn. So you didn't cross traffic.
It cuts off the cloverleaf.
Right. And so if you tried to grade separate those traffic signals, you would potentially lose that ramp terminal as it comes up to that same intersection. You would lose the ability maybe to do that just from a space standpoint. But as I said, as an engineer, we could probably make anything work. One project I talked about last time was the Sisters project. We actually closed downtown Sisters throughout the spring and redid the entire downtown. I thought I'd show you a couple photos of just how that project has turned out. It's been very successful in the community. Their businesses and the community are very happy with how the new pavement as well as the new features, as you see here, the sidewalks and the light posts have turned out. It's really been a great success for ODOT and for the community and for the businesses through downtown. Here's kind of a twilight shot showing the lights and so forth. So it's really turned out to be a beautiful little project for the community and for ODOT. Another project in Central Oregon, we worked with the Forest Service with some of the transportation enhancement funds to build a bike path or a multi-use path that connects Sun River north to Lava Butte and eventually into the Bend area network of bike trails. It was about a 5.5 mile project, about $1 million project to do that. Our contribution funding-wise was to improve one of the rail crossings in the area as part of the project. Part of the ribbon cutting for it, a little boy here, his name is Abel. His parents are very active outdoors and hikers in the area, and they had a son that wasn't able to join them except in his wheelchair. And so now with this path, the family is able to enjoy the outdoors of Central Oregon. So it was a nice little story as part of the ribbon cutting that we had. Further north, Big Junction is another Jobs and Transportation Act project. This is where Highway 97 meets Interstate 84 and crosses the Columbia River. North improvements that we have here are to rebuild the entire interchange, the structure over the freeway, the structure over the railroad, and as you can see in this photo, some approach work there to the south as Highway 97 comes down the hill into the Biggs area. Kerr Contractor out of Woodburn is the contractor on this. It's going well. We got one half of both those structures completed. They're well into the second half. Our anticipation opening for the entire project is next spring. But it's been a good project for the area. Mm-hmm. Last project I'd talk about is just outside of La Grande. We have, again, another Jobs and Transportation Act project to build a climbing lane in this area, but we combine that with a pavement project that we have. Again, like the last project I talked about, we're replacing concrete pavement, and so we have to go to a single-lane configuration for most of the summer. If you're familiar with that area, going into La Grande, it's a very narrow, windy canyon you go through, and so we've had many mobility issues with wide loads and freight moving through there, but we've been successful in our communication and outreach to deal with those. We're just finishing our second season of a three-season project, and it's been going very, very well. Here's some of the work, putting down some of the concrete pavements. One of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is the technology we're using more and more in construction, and particularly on this project. So here you have a paving machine putting down concrete pavement, and typically out in front of that we'd have a group of surveyors that would be lining out what we call a string line, and that paving machine would be following that string line. In this case, we don't have any of that. We have what you see in the foreground there, some survey total stations that are using GPS data to talk directly with the paving machine, and that paving machine is going totally off of that GPS data and going down the road, paving both the thickness and the alignment of the roadway based on that GPS data that's coming. That paving machine is moving. I actually got a tour of it a few weeks ago when I was out there. That paving machine is moving so fast, they're not using concrete mixers. Normally you'd see a concrete mixer show up and put concrete into this. They're actually using end dump trucks to dump concrete from the batch plant into the paving machine as it moves down the road. So very efficient for the contractor and for the motorist in moving the project forward and staying on schedule. Just kind of to that end, I thought I'd end with just a short video about a seminar that we put on, or a program we put on jointly with Federal Highway Administration this summer. Oregon is seen as a leader in using technology in construction. Our contractors are a big part of that, but also the amount of data that we provide to contractors to allow them to utilize some of that GPS and other technology. I thought I'd show you just a short video from a program that we had earlier this summer that kind of demonstrated what is available now, not in the future, but what's available now to improve the efficiencies of our contractors and our construction projects. Oftentimes you hear me when I'm up here talking about how a project came in under bid, or we have extra money. Part of the reason for that is the efficiency of our contractors and what they're investing in technology to make them more efficient. And this video will show you some of the technology they're using to find some of those efficiencies in their bidding. Wheel. Let's try.
Oregon, one of the leading states in the adoption of intelligent construction systems and technologies, hosted 50...
Oh, sorry.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, try this again. There we go.
Oregon, one of the leading states in the adoption of intelligent construction systems and technologies, hosted 50 participants and 200 attendees from 20 departments of transportation, local agencies, engineering consultants, and other industry representatives for 2 days of classroom presentations and field demonstrations of the latest technologies that can save time and money, build more precise and longer-lasting products, and reduce the impact on the environment.
One of the things we want you to notice, no stakes on the ground out here. No slope stakes, no grade stakes, no clearing stakes. We're able to get the same position without any type of staking at all. So sometimes this is referred to as stakeless grading. This is what you're seeing. It's not just stakeless, but in this case, stake-free grading.
Using the latest advances in technologies from GPS to LIDAR to robotics, new intelligent construction systems allow the creation of three-dimensional designs that are viewed on in-cab screens, where operators, using GPS or robotic survey instruments, monitor the exact location of the machine in the work zone, while the automated machine guidance system follows the design and controls hydraulics for precision blade control, accurate within 0.02 of a foot or better.
These systems can be equipped with what they call an auto side shift, where he can guide to the center line of a road or a ditch, and it'll keep that blade right on target all the way through as he drives through.
The new systems also collect as-built data as the machine cuts to grade, allowing operators to work faster, more consistently, and with less rework.
These guys will see an increase of about 30% in production rate, because they don't have to wait around for stakes. You also get an increased safety factor by not having guys out there in harm's way around the machine setting hubs. You just got the operator and the equipment to worry about.
Participants were given front row seats to learn how a paving operation benefits from using an intelligent compactor. Equipped with infrared sensors, allowing pass counts and temperature mapping to be viewed simultaneously on the operator's screen, the machine uses other sensors to measure mat stiffness, which gives the operator a relative indication of how well the compaction effort is working. The system offers more consistent compaction and increases productivity by automatically taking the most efficient roller pattern. Working alongside was the intelligent paving machine that achieves variable depth and slope paving to a 3D design. When a quarter-inch mistake over 10 miles of paving can cost $250,000, the new systems provide greater accuracy and smoothness through better material management, eliminating string lines, reducing labor, and costly rework. Also included in the event were class or field demonstrations of intelligent curb and wall construction, surveying in support of 3D design, key concepts of engineering automation, and utility location. The two-day conference received media coverage at the local and statewide level and at the national level through an industry trade publication.
Every Day Counts. It's a program under the Federal Highway Administration that's working to speed up construction projects around the nation.
That information is fed into machines like this grader right here that have a GPS. Here you can see the GPS is that white device up there, picking up the vehicle's location relative to the exact 3D project plan.
In the Oregon Daily Journal of Commerce, event coordinator Ron Singh, who is chief of surveys and geometronics manager for ODOT, acknowledged that the Oregon Department of Transportation will begin offering 3D data to contractors in 2015. He talked about how the new technologies affect the bidding process among contractors. The Oregon Daily Journal of Commerce quoted Ron as saying, "What's going to happen is those contractors with the technology will have less risk and their bids will come in lower than somebody who doesn't." In the article, longtime intelligent technology user K&E Excavation Incorporated talked about what the technologies mean to the company and what they could mean to others. K&E owner Kerry Kinsey was quoted as saying, "They just have to realize that if they're going to compete in tomorrow's marketplace, they're going to have to make the investment." Competing in the marketplace is the message that ODOT and the FHWA hope the attendees take home, so that the industry across the nation can get in step, not with the future, but with what is available now.
Amazing. That's amazing.
It's interesting stuff that we're implementing, and our contractors are working with us to really form a partnership with our designers and with the contractors to find as many efficiencies as we can in our projects. Ben, that concludes.
Great. How's the Woodburn interchange going?
It's one on one.
Senator Beyer and Senator Girard, the project is going very well. K&E contractor, which you saw highlighted in that video, is a contractor on that project. We're in the middle of a couple weeks of big changes right now. As you've been driving out there, we've shifted the main part of the roadway from one side to the other. Many of the ramps are going to shift, I believe, the night after next. Wednesday night, I think, is when the big shift is going to happen on the ramps. And so that marks kind of the halfway point in the roadway part of the project. But it continues to be well ahead of schedule, within budget, and doing very well.
What's the completion date?
Of the contract, we have until 2016, but I'm optimistic that this time next year we'll be pretty much wrapped up with the project.
Be in good shape for the Christmas season?
Yes. The contractor and our staff are keeping a close eye on what stage we'll actually be in during Christmas, and they're working to be in a very advantageous configuration to handle that traffic.
Nice not to have the middle lane turn into a parking lot again.
Yeah.
Senator.
Same two questions on Lincoln City. How's it going? What's the completion date?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, the project's going very well. Again, K&E is a contractor out at Lincoln City, a much smaller project, but working in a very difficult situation of being on 101 in the summertime around many, many businesses. We have a couple issues that we've worked through the summer with some of those business owners, but we've been successful in moving through those. I guess given what could have gone wrong with that project and kind of where we are, I'm very pleased with how that project is going. You know, off the top of my head, I don't know the completion date. I think it's next summer. Okay. We're going to go through this winter, and it'll be completed next summer, but I don't have an exact date for you.
That's fine.
Anything else for Paul? Oh, Senator Monroe.
Biggest bottleneck in my area is I-205 Abernathy Bridge to Stafford Road, where it narrows to two lanes. The rest of the freeway is all three lanes. When is that going to be fixed?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, we don't have any construction plans in that area. It's at best in the planning stages, but there's no funding identified to complete that project.
Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, projects like that are ones that we can aim to tackle in a 2015 transportation.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Nothing that a little more money won't fix. So. Thank you.
Good. Thanks.
Okay, now we're going to move to the county side. Any introduction?
Mr. Chair, I believe all of our panelists are here. We got four chairs still up there. Do we have four chairs still up there?
The technology is amazing.
No, I don't think they had a presentation. Maybe they didn't.
I have to say I'm kind of jealous of Paul. One, the equipment, and two, we should have done a video. But we do have a presentation for you.
I don't have as much money as he has to work with.
Welcome, everyone, particularly my commissioner, Commissioner Lycan.
All right, well, good morning, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Emily Ackland. I'm the County Road Program Manager at the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'm going to tee off the presentation this morning, but before I do, if it's okay, I'd like the panelists to introduce themselves.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm John Vile, and I'm the Roads and Parks Director for Jackson County and the President-elect of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors.
Mr. Chair, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Sid Lycan, Lane County Commissioner. I'm here in my acting in my capacity as chair of the Association of Oregon County's Transportation Policy Committee. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mary Stern, and I'm the new Transportation Policy Manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. Previously, I was the Yamhill County Commissioner for about 12 years and President of AOC last year, and I did not hire myself.
All right, well, before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge a couple other AOC folks that worked hard on this report, and that's Daniel Hauser in the audience and John O'Shell. So thank you very much for having us here this morning. It's very important to counties that this committee hear about the current needs of their road departments. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on introduction. Before I get started, I want to point out what you have in front of you. There's two handouts. One of them is the presentation you'll see, and the second one is the appendices for our report. The appendices contain information about the different regions we looked at across the state and dive a little deeper into information specific to those counties. You don't have the report in front of you, and that is because we're putting the finishing touches on that. It's going to be going to print here toward the end of the month, and as soon as we have it wrapped up, you will have a copy. All right, so county roads are a critical component of Oregon's integrated road system. And just as background, Oregon's road system totals approximately 68,000 miles of road, which are maintained primarily by counties, cities, federal land management agencies, and the Oregon Department of Transportation. Counties are responsible for the largest share of Oregon's roads, just under 27,000 miles. The county road system also includes 3,400 bridges and approximately 26,000 culverts. This 2014 study is actually an update of the 2006 study, and that was the first study that the County Roads Department did. This study, is an update of that report and looks at the same activities that county road departments do: construction, maintenance, preservation. The big difference with this study is that we do break it down into regions, and that's basically just so that you get a little more information about the counties specific in those regions. All right, so can we get that brought up? All right, thank you. Objectives of the study, and again, this study looks at 5 years, 2014 through 2018, and will describe anticipated funding for county road departments over the next 5 years, show the impact forecasted revenues will have on service delivery, discuss which activities are priority for counties, and demonstrate how different regions in Oregon are facing changes in revenue. Going into study methodology, in March of this year, each county receives a survey, and along with that survey, they received information on anticipated revenue. So each county was provided with forecasted revenues from the U.S. Forest Service, the Federal Highway Administration's Surface Transportation Program, or the STP program, and the State Highway Fund. Each of the 36 counties were also asked to provide estimates of locally generated funds for their county. Study assumptions, so basically what we told county road departments to consider as they were filling out their survey, was one, and this is a big one, the U.S. Forest Service Secure Rural Schools funding is not anticipated to be continued past 2014. And as you know, in 2014, county road departments that receive SRS funds did receive a payment, but again, we're not expecting Congress to pass another extension. So for the four final years of the study, the revenue that's presented is based on actual timber receipts. And those were forecasted based on the historic U.S. Forest Service data. And then two, numbers in the study do not reflect any increase in inflation except where noted. And so basically, we're coming in low. Expenditures. Each county identified the projects and services that are anticipated to be provided in the upcoming five calendar years, 2014 through 2018, if the anticipated funding levels and sources remain as forecasted. So we gave them the numbers. We asked them to figure out which road maintenance activities and projects they could do with the revenue that we forecasted. And then we asked them, based on the conditions of their road system, what are your system needs? So if you have projects that need to be done and maintenance activities that need to be conducted, what are they and how much would those projects cost? Expenditures were categorized by capital construction, pavement preservation, and maintenance repairs and operations. We did data review, so basically when we received all of those surveys back, we reviewed them to make sure that each county filled in the boxes the same. So, you know, when we were looking at pavement preservation activities, we made sure that all the counties included those projects under that category, just to make sure that they were consistent. And then finally, a few anomalies. Every data set has their outliers, so we wanted to point these things out just so that you have them in front of you. Multnomah County is legally bound to send an estimated $28.5 million each year to the cities in their county. Each intergovernmental agreement was developed as city annexations occurred and road jurisdiction was defined. This funding obligation is dedicated for road use and is based on thousands of miles of transferred system. This $28.5 million is included in the statewide analysis. So you'll see that in the revenue and the expenditure side. And again, another anomaly, Multnomah County, and please don't quote me as saying Multnomah County is an anomaly or an outlier, anticipate spending a total of $307 million to construct the Selwood Bridge. And $214 million is programmed to be spent between 2014 and 2016. So for the five-year period, if you look at that project alone, it constitutes just over half of the amount of money being spent on county bridge replacements in Oregon. So for that reason, when you look at our charts and our graphs, we do not include the Selwood Bridge project in there. It would just swing the data set. And then the last anomaly, Washington County anticipates approximately $39 million a year of property taxes to their county road fund, and that represents 85% of all property taxes collected for county roads. That is included in the statewide analysis, but when you look at our charts and you see the revenue side of things and the property taxes, just remember that 85% of that comes from Washington County. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. John Bow.
Thank you. As Emily said, we broke the study down into three major categories, maintenance and operations, pavement preservation, and capital construction. So the first area here of maintenance and operations, it was no surprise to us that this area constituted the bulk of the activities in which the counties are doing. Approximately 60% of all the monies that we spend on our county road system is spent to simply take care of the roads that we have, to operate them, to keep them safe, and to keep them passable. Many counties have moved large portions or all of their pavement preservation program and especially their capital program into maintenance and operations. Basically, the philosophy is if the roof is leaking, it's not time to add on to the house. And so most of the counties are completely focusing on taking care of what they have and not taking care of those capital needs that are severely needed in the counties. Several years ago, when I first started as a district manager managing roads, I had a boss that took me out for a drive. And he, as we were driving around, he asked me the question, what's the key to a good road? And thought for a minute, and I said, good pavement condition. And he said, no, the key to a good road is a good drainage system, because if the road's draining, it will keep everything else in good condition. So we drove a little longer, and he said, what do you think the number two priority for a good road is? And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, now it's time for the pavement. And his answer was, no, a good drainage system is the key to a good road. When he asked what the key to what the third priority was, I knew the answer at that point. But his point was well made, that the maintenance and operations that we do on the road network are not fancy. There's no ribbon cuttings. It's not glamorous work. You have to do it every year, and then the next year you got to do it all over again. But if you don't do it, your roads suffer severely, and that's where counties are putting our priorities right now. Unfortunately, just taking care of the roads that we have right now, we're falling behind in that category, not to mention the pavement preservation and capital needs. You can see the kinds of activities listed up here with grading gravel roads, traffic control, things like striping, signing, drainage repairs, and snow removal. Go ahead. So the next category that we asked people to focus on and to try to assess their needs and where are they spending their money was pavement preservation. Pavement preservation is the area that we get the biggest bang for the buck when we spend funds in these areas. While those the other activities that we noted, you have to do them every year. You have to replace signs every year. You have to stripe every year. You have to clean ditches every year. When we can spend money on pavements, it extends the life of the pavement, and we can take advantage of that investment the most. This chart that you have in your packet and shown on the screen is a chart that the state uses, the feds use, and I think every county and city road official around the state and then around the nation uses it to help policymakers understand that when we invest in preserving our pavements, when we do things like thin pavement overlays, chip seals, and seal coats, it buys us a tremendous amount. It maintains our investment, and it buys us a tremendous amount of time in keeping that going. And as this chart shows, when you invest at a dollar up on the top where you're doing these thin lift treatments, you save $3 to $5 or $8 to $12 down the road. If we had money to do more of this, we would save a tremendous investment that we have in our pavement systems right now. If there was one area that was identified in this study where road officials were asked, if you had more money, where would you put it? It was in pavement maintenance, because it maintains your investment. And it's an area that we're finding ourselves falling further and further behind. The study found that we're approximately 37% funded in this area, so nearly 60% unfunded. And the last category that we would like to do is more capital projects. These are the projects that the public loves. You have ribbon cuttings, and everybody loves to drive on a new road and a new alignment. But frankly, most counties have severely cut or eliminated their capital program entirely. It is the largest need in the study area, and Commissioner Lyken and Ms. Stern will talk about that more in a moment. But it's an area that we simply are not investing into the degree that we need. One thing I would note is while many counties have congestion and capacity issues, every single county has a county filled full of roads that were built in the 1930s, that were built for Model Ts, that are in severe need of upgrade. And that's a feature that you're going to find in every single county across the state. And with that, I'll pass it on to Commissioner Lyken, who will talk about some of the specific needs that the study found.
Well, thank you. Again, my name is Sid Lyken, Lane County Commissioner, and I'm here as my capacity as AOC Transportation Chair. I'd like to just touch on a little bit on the funding mechanisms or lack thereof maybe I should put in place, because I think, as we all know, I think we're beginning to wonder if Congress is actually serious about transportation funding. And I think at this point in time, I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. With reauthorization going out through 8 months, now we're having to take a look at what kind of partnerships are we going to have to strengthen. I think the partnership here with the state, I think from the local side, and I'll get into that a little bit. But what I want to do is touch first on the first chart, road fund revenues. Clearly, when you look at county funding, it's clearly still comes from the state highway fund. But as you go through the chart, I think the one, and Emily touched on this earlier, the one that I think that really comes out is USFS. That's the Forest Service. So if you think about, this is really part of the secure rural schools and the authorization that went on. So if you think about 2000 through 2006, Lane County was actually the largest recipient of those dollars. That money was just under $19 million a year. Last year, our payment was $6.7 million. So that's a third of what it was during the peak. You coincide that with when it was actually linked to harvest. I think the last year that was 89 and 90. That number was roughly about 16 to 17 million. you index that to inflation now, that's about $32 million. And so that's really, when you look at actual dollars compared to what it was in 1989-90, compared today, we are so far down, sometimes I think we need to go out and find gift bags and hand out to folks to see if we can get some transportation funding somewhere. So that's one I think that really, and the Southwest counties in particular, but I think counties throughout Oregon rely on those Forest Service payments. You have counties in the southwest part of Oregon that have property tax rates, and this is where, when you look at property taxes, okay, Josephine County and Curry County could care less. Their rates at 58 and 59 cents per thousand. You know, Lane County's rich at $1.32, and so compared to those two, but so that's it really has become a significant challenge for us. The next chart will be kind of breaks it down to the average state highway fund, the allocation. State at 58%, cities at 17%, counties at 25%. One thing that, and this has been somewhat traditional because my prior life as mayor of the city of Springfield for 10 years, while we had a public works department and while we did projects, all the surveying and engineering came from the county, not from the city. So that's where it's very important that counties have the public works, these road funds in place, because that partnership was key in some of our major transportation thoroughfares. And I know Senator Beyer would know this, in particular the Peace Health project. That roadway was an outstanding partnership, really, between Peace Health itself, but also between Lane County and the city of Springfield. Next chart, please. This is the graphic, I think, that says it all. You can look at that chart. I probably don't need to say too much about it. It really does show the decline overall in the funds that are coming, in particular from the Forest Service and SRS payments. By the way, if we're still linked to cut, it's interesting. The most interesting chart I look at today is harvesting on private lands compared to harvesting on federal lands. Private lands is kind of like this, kind of a straight. Federal lands just down like this. And so it's basically very little harvest on federal lands at this point in time. And whether that is going to be settled back in D.C. at this point in time, I think it's anybody's, you know, you might as well throw a quarter up in the air and see which side it lands on. Some of our other road revenues, obviously we STIP funding. I know that I serve on my MPO, so the STIP funding is now, and Lane County does officially now have an act. It's been in place, I think, about a year, and has actually been performing quite well, so we're very proud of where that's going. I want to, again, thank the legislature for their efforts in helping us put that together. Some of the grants, whether it's federal and state, this is the part I think that gets frustrating right now. Is we're in Lane County in particular, we're working on a jurisdictional, hoping to work on a jurisdictional transfer of territorial highway. In the past days, with those road fund reserves, we probably could have already had that settled. Today, we're having to fight for Tiger Grant money, and you know we're in a line that's miles long. Even though we feel it's a good project, well, so does every other city and county in the United States feel like they have good Tiger Grant projects as well. I think Washington County is moving forward on a local option in November. That'll be a vehicle registration fee. I think other counties are looking at that, including Lane County. We may be looking at something in May. Again, it kind of depends on what potential package may come from the legislature. So, but in a... snapshot, that's kind of where we are. And the final piece is just the overall growing cost of construction. If you just look at 2002 to where we are today, construction costs continue to rise. Even though we will say in the last couple of years they've remained fairly flat, the expectation is with, who knows, the cost of fuel, it may be rising up again. So far it's been flat here the last couple of years. We've been fortunate for that. But the reality is, I think as John mentioned, capital projects are just not happening in the counties at this point in time. We're just hoping to have dollars available just to maintain. And I think maybe Mary will cover this as well, but I know in Lane County alone, we are responsible for over 400 county bridges. So that's just Lane County alone. You think about bridges throughout the state that the counties have to maintain. And so that's kind of sums up the from the revenue standpoint. And I will now turn it over to our new AOC policy director for transportation, Mary Stern, who I was able to serve with her as AOC president. Now we work together on transportation. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thank you, Senators. So the bottom line here is to adequately and fully address the needs of the county road system throughout the state over the next 5 years, we could and should spend $2.34 billion on capital construction. We'll only be able to spend $670 million. We could and should spend $730 million on pavement preservation. We'll only be able to spend $270 million. And we could and should spend $1.6 billion on maintenance, operations, and repair. We'll only be able to spend $1.22 billion. And as you can see from the chart on the right-hand side, counties are focusing on maintenance, repair, and operations, and pavement preservation. As John mentioned, this is where we're getting our biggest bang for the buck. But it also means that we're not spending money or adequately investing on capital projects. You'll see here the annual numbers, and the bottom line is we need nearly $1 billion annually, but anticipate receiving only half that. The shortfall per year is just over $505 million. And what does this mean to your area? As was mentioned, you received an appendix containing details on each of the regions. The County Road Needs Study categorizes Oregon's 36 counties into four distinct regions: Eastern, Southwest, Willamette Coast, and Metro. The counties are clustered by similarities in geography, economies, population distribution, and common challenges in funding road projects. And looking at the anticipated funding for each of the regions, you can see three of the four receive approximately half of what they need. Eastern Oregon faces the biggest shortfall, receiving only about a third of the funding it needs. And this is not surprising, given the high number of road miles, which are greatly impacted by extreme swings in the climate, and the low population. I don't know if you can see that sign there, the little one in the middle, road closed. So as you've seen here today, the overall need is enormous. The first transportation priority of counties is to maintain and preserve our road system. Capital needs are growing rapidly, but we first must address the system we have. That's why AOC, as a member of the Oregon Transportation Forum, has been working on developing a proposal for the 2015 legislature. AOC supports a gas tax and registration fee increase, as well as indexing those taxes and fees. We also strongly support the adherence to the 50-30-20 split. Now, for a bit of perspective, if the gas and weight mile taxes were raised so the counties could address the $505 million annual shortfall, there would need to be an increase of 64 cents per gallon. 42 cents would go to capital and 22 cents to maintenance, repairs, and operations. Now, I don't see Santa Claus sitting anywhere up there. So we realize that that is just unattainable. However, we will be working with you and asking for your assistance as we address the needs of the county road system. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Senator Durrett?
Did you look at the variation of registration fees? What I'm looking at specifically is you have electric cars who aren't paying much. Then you have my wife has a chick car that's a Volkswagen that gets about 50 miles to the gallon. I have a SUV that gets 16. There's a little bit of, it seems to me like we need to have some type of variable registration fee to compensate for the high mileage using cars, the electric cars, et cetera, versus the gas guzzlers like yours truly drives.
And the proposal that's working its way to the Oregon Transportation Forum right now is looking at that as well. It's difficult to assess, but they are working on that.
One follow-up. In 2007, I actually had a bill to make it 50-30-20 and put it in statute, the distribution ratio. The counties and the city actually opposed it at that time because they didn't want to interfere with the relationships of ODOT. Now you're asking for a strict strictly enforce the 50-30-20, but that isn't for all contracts. That's for all new agreements, or is that how are you reading that? Because, you know, right now, if it's 58-25-17, that's kind of the old. That's the old contracts, if I'm not mistaken.
I think what you Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, I think what you saw up here was the average since the beginning of time when that split was going on.
Okay.
So since 1986, I believe, any new funding has been split 50-30-20.
Okay.
And we'd like it to stay that way.
All right.
Senator Roll.
I think it's interesting. Of course, I represent the urban area, the metro area, and that region. And I think it's interesting that urban areas that are in cities like Portland get the Multnomah County portion of the Multnomah County cut and the city of Portland cut. And that's true of Hillsboro, and that's true of Beaverton, and that's true of Oregon City, and so on. However, there are very large unincorporated urban areas in Clackamas County and in Washington County, and my understanding is they get their share of the county money, but they don't get any share of the city money, so they're really cutting their own apron strings, you might say, in terms of transportation funding by refusing to be incorporated. Is that accurate?
Chair Beyer and Senator Monroe, yes, I believe you are correct. I could add a little bit to that and just say that Multnomah County also maintains several of the big bridges, the big Willamette bridges.
I would add, Senator, that as Commissioner Lycan and I had a recent conversation on that, I noticed that some of those areas that I represent were having their roads paved when the cities didn't have the money to. Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Very informative. All right. Now to oil train safety. Patrick, anything to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We're going to have a brief. Carmen Ford from the governor's office is going to lead us off, and then we'll hear from Mayor Babbitts from the city of Hood River. Union Pacific Railroad is here in the room. They're listening. They're available if the committee has questions on the subject. See where the discussion goes. And Senator Thompson.
Did you want to start, Senator?
Sure. I'll just switch seats here. I just wanted to give the pleasure of Chair Beyer and members of the committee, esteemed committee, I might add, probably the best committee on the Senate side, undoubtedly.
Probably.
It is, undoubtedly. Great pleasure for me to introduce the mayor of Hood River, Mayor Arthur Babbitts. Earlier this year, I attended a meeting in Hood River about train safety traveling through the gorge with all the episodes that have happened across country with some oil trains, and I listened to the report, and Mayor Babbitts has just an incredible. He's done a tremendous amount of work. His profession as an engineer, he looks at this as a very from a great perspective, and I thought it would be very educational if he would come to one of our legislative meetings. I want to thank Senator Beyer for having the meeting, and Patrick was he's the best as far as setting up a meeting. He handled everything, and we all know, being on the committee, that what a great job he does. And then Carmen Four came up to Hood River. We had a little meeting in Hood River with the mayor, and talked about what she was doing, and she agreed to come in and speak. And so I think you'll be very enlightened after this report, and just wanted a chance to introduce the mayor. And thank you, Carmen, for coming, too.
Thank you very much.
Great. You bet.
Thank you. Carmen, did you want to start?
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, and members of the committee, and specifically Senator Thompson as well, for having me come speak to you on this topic today. And I would also like to echo high praise for Mayor Babbitts as well. He's done some excellent thinking on this topic, and I think will be very illustrative when he gives his testimony. For the record, my name is Carmen Foer, and I'm the Sustainable Communities and Transportation Policy Advisor for Governor John Kitzhaber. And I want to thank you for inviting me to come before you today to speak on the important topic of rail safety. The volume of crude oil moving through our nation's rail network has dramatically increased in recent years as new drilling technologies have unlocked previously unreachable oil in the U.S. Bakken formation and in the Canadian oil sands. This production increase in North America is so significant that it has caused a shift in how oil is transported to refineries in the United States. Traditionally, and even today, the vast majority of crude oil for U.S. markets is transported still by pipeline or by ocean-going tanker from production sources originating abroad. Most recent estimates detail this to be about 93% of all oil moving to refineries in the United States. Much of this crude is delivered to refineries located in coastal regions like the Gulf Coast, as well as along the West Coast in California and in Washington. Pipelines and water-going vessels have been the preferred mode of choice for producers, primarily because they are low cost and because they are high capacity. But a 2013 report by the Association of American Railroads detailed an exponential shift in the shipment of oil by train in the United States in the last few years. In 2006, approximately 3,000 shipments of oil were sent by train. But by 2013, that had increased to approximately 400,000 shipments of oil by train. Estimates for 2014 peg it at 650,000 carloads of crude oil will be shipped by train. So why the shift? Well, neither pipelines nor water-going vessels well serve crude oil production located in the center of the continent. Consequently, producers in these newer regions have had to figure out how to move their commodity from the center of the continent to refineries located along the coast. Given its capacity and sophistication, the existing rail network became a go-to way to move crude oil. But increased rail shipments and major spills in this last year, including the disaster at Lac Megantic, Quebec, have raised serious concerns in Oregon about the shipment of crude oil by rail. Is it safe? Are local emergency responders prepared? How would an accident impact a community or an environmentally sensitive area? Are the railroads doing all they can to prepare for and prevent an accident? And are federal and state regulators doing all they can to oversee the safe transport of crude oil and other hazardous materials? To better understand the implications of the increase in traffic, Governor John Kitzhaber called for a statewide review of rail safety in Oregon. Last July, he released his preliminary statewide rail safety review that outlined a number of areas where railroads, the federal government, and state and local governments can play a role in improving rail safety in Oregon. So first with the federal level. Federal regulators provide the primary oversight role in the safe movements of hazardous materials. While shipments of crude oil by rail at the current scale is relatively new, long-standing proposals at the federal level to improve rail safety have been identified and yet have been slow to be implemented or addressed. One relates to tank car standards and train speeds. For months, the governor has called on the U.S. Department of Transportation to establish tougher tank car standards, replacing the commonly referred to DOT 111 cars, to something that actually the National Transportation Safety Board has been calling for since 1991, and also for lowering train speeds carrying crude oil. Combined, these actions are arguably the surest way to improve the safe transport of volatile hazardous materials by rail. In an encouraging move, the USDOT released draft rules earlier this summer that would accomplish both of these goals. Another issue at the federal level is the implementation of comprehensive rail safety plans for railroads. Now, railroads are required to prepare safety plans for how they would respond to an incident on their rail lines. Currently, railroads are required to complete either what's called a basic response plan or a comprehensive response plan for the transport of oil. These plans are determined based on the volume capacity of a tank car transporting oil. Comprehensive plans are subject to Federal Railroad Administration approval and must ensure by contract or by other means that personnel and equipment are able to handle a worst-case discharge. Basic plans are not subject to a similar review. The threshold to trigger a comprehensive plan is if a railroad is hauling individual tank cars that hold more than 1,000 barrels, but the commonly used DOT 111 tank car generally holds around 700 barrels. The National Transportation Safety Board has recommended that the threshold be lowered to take into account the use of unit trains or blocks of tank cars transporting oil, which were rarely in use in 1996 when the current regulations went into effect. This would be more in keeping with the way the U.S. Coast Guard regulates marine tank vessels hauling oil. When they submit their worst-case discharge plan, they take into account the entire cargo on the vessel. The same should be true for rail. Other steps at the federal level that should be looked at include the implementation of positive train control. This is an important safety tool that would help minimize human error, which may lead to rail accidents for both freight and passenger trains. Another area where the state has commented to the Federal Railroad Administration is that the FRA should offer guidance to states on updated staffing levels. The FRA has said that it will use data-driven techniques to direct track inspections in response to increased oil trains. With changing practices, the FRA should provide to states in the State Safety Participation Program, of which Oregon is one of these states, updated guidance on the number of rail safety inspectors needed to adequately perform inspections on all trackage within a state's boundaries. Now, while the problem is truly nationwide in scope, the Governor's Safety Review revealed a number of changes that need to be made both by the railroads and by the state as well. One relates to the notification to emergency responders about the movements of hazardous materials through a community. In the past, railroads have said information on hazardous material shipments were available to emergency responders, but only upon request. We have found many emergency responders are unaware of individual railroads' procedures to access this information. The mechanisms to receive timely notification about the movement of hazardous materials from railroads for use by emergency responders, either for training purposes or to respond to a rail incident, has needed improvement. Additionally, the mechanisms for the receipt and distribution of annual reports regarding the movement of these materials from railroads to state agencies also needed improvement. State agencies should act as a hub for the collection of this information and be an advocate on behalf of local communities, but they had been lax in the collection and dissemination of this information. State agencies have begun to do a better job coordinating with the railroads and local emergency responders to ensure this information is accessible. Now, the U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox issued an executive order on May 7th of this year and then proposed a rule on July 23rd of this year requiring railroads hauling trains with more than 1 million gallons of Bakken crude oil to disclose this information to state emergency response commissions. In Oregon, this is the Office of the State Fire Marshal. The governor believed this draft rule should be amended to require railroads notify states of all crude oil being hauled by shippers, regardless of its origin. This is also in line with recommendations by Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley. We also identified that state agencies need to proactively identify and propose changes to outdated statutes, administrative rules, and procedures related to rail safety. On a related note to the one I discussed earlier, ODOT has begun the rulemaking process to update and modernize the state's rules about reporting the movement of hazardous materials by rail. A rulemaking advisory committee made up of emergency responders, environmental representatives, railroad officials, and stakeholders are currently working with ODOT as the agency progresses through this rulemaking. Again, the point of this work is to ensure emergency responders have access to more and better information about the movement of oil and other hazardous materials through their communities so they can effectively prepare for and respond to an incident. The Office of the State Fire Marshal, through its CERC, will also update outdated OARs to ensure they line up with recent emergency orders and consider additional changes once the new federal regulations are in place. Again, the rules proposed by the Secretary won't be completed, we assume, until the end of this year. Another area is that state agencies need to ensure that adequate staff are in place to conduct rail and hazardous materials inspections. In previous years, positions related to rail and hazardous material inspections went unfilled as a cost savings measure or for other purposes. Well, this has not been the practice of current administrations. It has happened in the past. You'll be interested to know that at the governor's direction, ODOT has already initiated the process of adding 4 new rail inspectors to complement its already aggressive safety program. These additional inspectors will allow ODOT to increase rail safety through prevention. Inspectors monitor train speeds, track conditions, train car placement, and tanker valve closure settings. They walk rails, inspect cars, review procedures, and evaluate safety at crossings. The new inspectors will allow ODOT to have at least 2 inspectors covering each safety discipline, including an additional inspector for hazardous materials shipments. Now, railroads need to be responsible for all on-site and off-site consequences of an incident involving hazardous materials on their lines. While this is already required under existing federal regulation, railroads must demonstrate they are fully capable to meet this responsibility. Part of that demonstration includes providing timely emergency notification to local officials along their lines and to provide better information on resources in place to mitigate, contain, and clean up hazardous material release in the case of an accident. Another issue is that the railroads needed to provide the state of Oregon and emergency responders detailed information on the cache of equipment they have to respond to an incident. Without this information, it's nearly impossible for local emergency responders to assess if adequate equipment is available in the event of a hazardous material incident on the rail line. Talks are ongoing with the railroads to provide this information to state and local responders for their use. Another issue for the railroads was the need to set up an improved and well-tested mechanism for emergency responders to access the train manifests in case of an incident. Now, the Association of American Railroads has said it's been working with partner railroads to create an online site where emergency responders can access this information in the event of an accident. It also has a 1-800 number that emergency responders can use to access this information. Now, NTSB investigations have illustrated that in past accident, manifest information has been unreliable and even difficult to access when an accident has occurred. Shoring up both of these processes to get this information and ensuring this information is reliable is paramount in the event of an emergency response. And my communications with the railroads and with the association acknowledge this need. State agencies must also regularly review emergency plans prepared by railroads handling hazardous materials, including crude oil. This review should be comprehensive to ensure plans comply with state and federal regulations, as well as adequately protect the public and the environment. State agencies must conduct exercises with railroads to validate emergency plans and build strong public-private partner relationships. And finally, new resources are likely needed for emergency responders in Oregon. The governor has recommended that policymakers look at developing a fee system for transporting crude oil and other hazardous materials by rail in the state. These funds would be dedicated for emergency response planning, equipment purchases, training, exercises, and medical services to ensure proper preparedness in the event of a rail emergency. Since the release of the governor's report, state budget officers have been reviewing the details of these individual fees, what they raise and what they are used for, and will help develop a set of recommendations for appropriate fees that are needed to assist, principally in the work of emergency responders. This work will be informed by a report released this November by the State Fire Marshal's Office. They have been tasked to work with local fire chiefs, tribal governments, regional and bi-state entities to quantify the equipment and materials they have and what may be needed for a response. They are to report their findings to the governor and the legislature upon completion. So in conclusion, the governor, has been very concerned about rail safety and shared the perspective of outgoing NTSB Chairman Deborah Hersman when she said in her farewell speech at the National Press Club that U.S. communities were not prepared to respond adequately to a worst-case accident involving trains carrying crude oil and ethanol, that federal regulators were behind the curve in addressing the transport of hazardous liquids by rail, given the dramatic increase in movement of oil and other flammable materials by train, and that the petroleum industry and emergency responders didn't have provisions in place to address the worst-case scenario event involving a train carrying crude oil or ethanol. Since that time, the USDOT has issued an emergency order and a draft comprehensive rule on rail safety. The Secretary has proposed additional funds for training emergency responders, and policymakers, rail operators, and state regulators have taken steps to shore up rail safety here in Oregon. But much of this work isn't finished, and in many instances, this work will be ongoing. While the overall percentage of crude oil transported by rail is small, the nature of the commodity, how it is shipped under regulatory rules and regulations, and how and where the commodity flows matters. Rail lines pass through countless communities, both large and small, through places that are environmentally sensitive as well. Therefore, we must be diligent in our work to protect our special places and the people of the state. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions at your consideration.
Curiosity, Carmen, how much of the volume of the Bracken is coming on the Oregon side of the river versus on the Washington side?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, most of the Bakken crude at this time is being hauled by BNSF on the Washington state side. They do cross over, and some of the Bakken crude is going up on the what's called the A-line in the northwest area of the state. UP, and this was my last knowledge, and the representatives with UP could update me on this, but they are hauling crude that comes out of Utah, and they run it down the center, the main trunk down the center of the state.
Hmm. I would assume most of it was going up to the Puget Sound refineries.
Senator Beyer, I believe it depends on who their customer is, if the refineries are in California or if the refineries are in the state of Washington. I believe that BNSF does serve refineries in the state of Washington.
Thank you. Other questions, Carmen, before we move on to the mayor? Senator Gerard?
Yeah, it just seems to me we had the huge judgment on the BP oil spill. We had the huge judgment on the Valdez oil spill, that if the railroad itself, the liability is going to be huge. And so just as an investor in their stock or whatever, you would assume that they would do everything possible to limit the liability exposure. But what you tend to be saying is that they're not. And so I'm kind of curious, from the railroad's perspective, if they think they are, because it just seems to me the liability of having a spill could be catastrophic in terms financially.
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, as it relates to liability, I mean, part of this, you do mention two waterborne accidents, you know, the BP oil spill and the Exxon Valdez, and much of our federal regulation really sprang out of the Exxon Valdez incident. And again, recognizing, and specifically at that time, the vast majority of oil was moving by ocean-going tanker or by pipe. What has happened in this last year, specifically in reaction to the Lac-Mégantic accident, which did bankrupt that particular rail operator, in the United States, for example, Genesee and Wyoming upped its liability insurance. They subsequently had a derailment near Aliceville, Alabama, I believe in November of last year. Because they'd upped their liability insurance, they were able to cover any costs associated with that derailment. Because they do have to purchase liability insurance, and there have been ongoing issues back and forth before the Surface Transportation Board with shippers and rail operators who is liable. But ultimately, I think the railroads have taken this very seriously and are using their liability coverage to cover the costs associated with a potential incident. So that's the mechanism they've been using thus far. I think the railroads specifically could be more precise to what they're doing at this particular moment.
No.
Anybody consider building a new refinery right where the source of the new oil is, North Dakota, rather than to transport the crude oil by rail to existing refineries that are built on the coast?
Senator Beyer, Senator Monroe, I haven't heard anything to that effect at this time, although there's an elegance.
Logical to me.
There's an elegance in that. In Washington, a lot of the debate, which we don't have here in Oregon, relates around the notion of pipeline versus rail. And what's going on? Did this force the hand of the Keystone Pipeline conversation? Committee staff will remind members in D.C. that really speaks more specifically specifically to the shale oil being produced in Canada. And there still are estimates that we don't have on the books pipeline capacity that could cover the need of the production sources in the United States right now. But as it relates to refineries, I have to presume someone's considering it if North Dakota's land use laws would allow for it. I just don't know.
Senator, I don't think there's been a new refinery built in this country in over 50 years.
That's exactly it.
The environmental requirements. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee. I certainly appreciate your taking time to add this session to your busy agenda. I'm used to sitting on your side of the chair, so I will get right to the point. I understand the limits of your jurisdiction on this issue, so I am not going to lecture you on climate change. I'm not going to ask you to stop rail transport. I am not here to demonize our railroads. They do not select what they haul, and they have every motivation to conduct their business in as safe a manner as they can. The issue is one of readiness. No one, not the railroads, not the state regulators, not the first responders, had any reason to believe that rails would be acting as oil pipelines just a few years ago. No one expected this volume of oil, no one knew about the volatility, and no one is prepared. Today, there is Bakken crude and Utah crude traveling through the gorge in tanker cars that we know are unsuited to the task. While we don't have the jurisdiction to stop them, it is our obligation to be ready to respond to a potential disaster. When I started seeing news items about exploding rail cars in cities that didn't look very much different from Hood River, I started by asking two very basic questions. Number one, what is the likelihood of a serious accident in the gorge? And number two, are we prepared to respond? I assumed that since rail was already traveling on, that since oil was already traveling by rails, someone must have done a risk analysis of the likelihood of the accident and the expected cost in life and property. But all I could find was a study by the Port of Vancouver, which covered 3,000 feet of trail after $500,000 of track improvement, with the train braking from 10 miles per hour to a stop. My concern is for the full 75 miles of the gorge, with trains traveling in excess of 50 miles per hour on tracks that haven't necessarily just been upgraded, with grade crossings, bad weather, and landslides. Lacking anything better, I resorted to a back-of-the-envelope calculation. That's an engineer's term for an estimate used to determine at least the order of magnitude, the number of zeros of the problem. Without boring you with the details, I used numbers from the peer-reviewed study in the Transportation Research Record, which reviewed all of the official U.S. rail accidents reports for the last decade. Projecting from last decade's national numbers, if the roughly 150 miles of rail in the gorge, that's 75 on both sides, were completely typical in track condition, traffic, and everything else, we could expect to see an average of 1.2 accidents in the gorge every year, with 6.2 cars derailed. That's roughly an accident a year, most of which we assume would be low speed, with a few cars hopping the track, and hopefully the cars would be containing nothing more hazardous than sriracha sauce. But over 50 years, there's a real chance that one of these accidents will be significant. Most people are not very good at evaluating small risks. Either something is very likely, or we don't give it a second thought. So let's compare this risk with something that we've decided we need to prepare for. Over the next 50 years, the best estimates are 7 to 15% of a great earthquake that's magnitude 9 affecting the entire Pacific Northwest. Yeah. These odds have caused us to change building code, to conduct regular emergency drills, to relocate emergency facilities, and they've caused you to request a detailed plan describing how Oregon will get back on its feet after such a disaster. While an oil train accident would be much more localized, I argue it warrants serious action at the state and national level, as well as the local level. Which brings me to question two. Are we prepared for such an accident? I prepared 19 questions for each of the first responder agencies in the gorge. I wanted this to be non-political, fact-based, so I was careful not to ask broad questions like, are you prepared? But instead, ask what sort of personnel, equipment, and training is in place to respond. I sent my questions to the chiefs of the fire departments and districts throughout the gorge, both in Washington and Oregon, as agencies on both sides of the river respond to emergencies on both sides of the river through mutual aid packs. If a train with Bakken crude derails in Bingen, Washington, the Hood River Fire Department will be among the first responders. I won't call my study definitive, but I've got enough responses to start to paint a picture. In the event of an oil train derailment, local responders will be on the scene within minutes with firefighters, mostly volunteer, but in some cases paid staff. They will respond with an array of equipment selected to fight the expected mix of calls: brush or wildland fires, structure fires, and freeway accidents. Other agencies will respond to a mutual aid request within minutes to tens of minutes. Many of the responders will be like our own Senator Thompson, who is a volunteer with the Pine Grove Fire District. They will attempt to communicate with the railroad to verify the contents of the derailed cars, though there was some concern over the accuracy of that response. Few of the local agencies have Class B foam necessary to extinguish a burning oil tanker car, and those that do have little of it. They have minimal booming to contain oil on the river, and they do not have fire boat capabilities locally. The most prepared local agencies have equipment to respond to a single tanker car involved in a freeway accident. A few reported training by the railroads for their firefighters, and they say that the railroads are very willing and very helpful. Yet most of the districts reported that they had not had that training, and they had not had any planning contacts with the railroad. Several expressed concern about the cost of a response and the lack of certainty for reimbursement. Chief Palmer at the Mid-Columbia Fire and Rescue in the Dalles, one of the best-equipped districts in the region, said this. MCFR responds to hazardous materials incidents in first responder defensive level within our service area. The district does not provide hazardous materials offensive level of service. Calls requiring this level of service are referred to the state hazmat team, typically Gresham number 3. For a large-scale incident such as you described, our resources would be overwhelmed very quickly. We would not have the adequate resources to handle such an incident. We would have to request mutual aid from other agencies, Hazmat 3, and it could very likely require state mobilization. I've confirmed with the railroads that that's a pretty fair picture of their expectation of the first response. For a small event, local agencies may be in a position to try to limit the spread of the fire, but they do not have the equipment, personnel, or training to deal with the derailment itself. That is what the railroads will tell them, and we hope that they listen, as it is a matter of their own safety. Respondents expect to be waiting hours or even days for state and railroad assets to be brought in from Portland or other regional caches or even from elsewhere in the country. You've probably all seen the Columbia on a day when the wind whips the water into white caps. Containing a fire or an oil spill is unusually challenging in the gorge, and time is usually not on your side. In a major event, such as we saw in Quebec or Lynchburg, Virginia, where the threat reaches a half mile or even a mile from the tracks, the more important question may be how effectively and quickly can the area be evacuated. This is the sort of thing that small towns simply aren't prepared for. Only two of the cities that responded had described general evacuation plans. Only one described an actual drill. How would you evacuate Hood River, with the railroad splitting our town in half, running right next to the freeway, and separating our downtown from the beaches and the industrial areas? I recently spoke with the mayors of Bingen and White Salmon, Washington, the two cities nearest to Hood River, and we've asked our city managers to contact the railroads and to discuss with them doing a tabletop exercise for just such a disaster. We still haven't figured out how to make this happen, but I'm happy to report that both BNSF and Union Pacific are conducting basic first responder training sessions in our area this week. That's a good first step so that responders such as Senator Thompson know how to keep themselves safe if they're responding to a derailment. BNSF told me that the big problem is getting local agencies to show up for the training. Most volunteers have actual real jobs, such as Senator Thompson, has two real jobs actually, and it's hard for them to find time for the additional training. So are we prepared to respond to such an accident today? Very unlikely. We have a patchwork of local emergency plans for serious incidents, but it would be naive to think that they address a potential disaster of this magnitude. Our city recently completed a waterline project. Before we could move a teaspoonful of dirt, we were required to document that the bathrooms at City Hall, where you can pay your water bill, are ADA compliant. Yet this oil pipeline is already operating through the heart of our cities, and somehow it escaped the requirement to demonstrate that emergency plans, equipment, personnel, and training are in place all along the route to respond to catastrophic derailment. The report that Ms. Four presented is a great start. It does an excellent job at summarizing the problem. It makes it clear that the state does not know very much about what equipment and response the railroads can mount, and this state does not know much about the local first response. It raises concerns about the local level of local safety inspections, and I hope you all see this as a direct challenge. Having a report is of little value unless it spurs action. I hope that you will be asking relevant state agencies to keep you informed, and that as they address inspection equipments and training deficiencies, they report back to you. In November, you will get a very important report from the State Fire Marshal's office. They will inventory all local, state, and railroad assets available to respond. This will be the definitive analysis of our deficiencies in readiness for the potential oil train disaster. This report will deserve swift and definitive action. To be perfectly candid, it is my fear that people are hoping that this problem will go away. Some hope that new oil pipelines will be built, that rail traffic will be diverted, and the problem will be solved. But wishing is not planning. Today, Bakken crude passes within a mile of my city. Today, Utah crude passes right through my downtown. We are playing the odds, odds which haven't even been calculated, and that's just not acceptable. I started by talking about jurisdiction. I told you I wouldn't ask you to stop the trains because you can't. But the state has a major role in planning and responding to such a disaster, which would quickly overwhelm all of our local resources. We need state leadership and resources in the middle of this. It is not reasonable to believe that Hood River or Troutdale or Mosier or Rufus can take this on alone. I'll get back to the earthquake analogy. It's easy to lose focus on something which you think might not happen for a long time if you're lucky. As far as gorge communities are concerned, we're talking about the big one. Please keep the governor's office focused on oil train safety. Please keep the state fire marshal's office focused on oil train safety. When they report to you in November describing the holes in our ability to respond to a rail disaster, please act. While you may not control what travels through our towns, it is our obligation to be ready to protect life and property if or when the worst does happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. Comments? Senator?
I like your presentation, but there is one thing that kind of bothers me, and that is tying it so much to the big earthquake. I just hate to be a bearer of bad news. An oil spill probably isn't going to be our biggest concern. It really, truly isn't. I mean, we got Portland's going to lose some skyscrapers. Loss of life's going to be huge. The coast is not going to have, you know, I mean, the coast is going to be a disaster as well. The bridge you're talking about, getting the Hood River Fire Department over to the Washington side, probably isn't going to be there. However, I do believe that, you know, that we do need to have be prepared, or at least know who's in charge of, if we do have a spill, who's to do what. And so I think, but I don't think tying it to the earthquake probably is that great of an idea. But, I mean, that's just me.
Senator Girard, Chair Beyer, I appreciate that point. And actually, I think you may have misunderstood the reason I brought that up. The issue that I was trying to address is that it's difficult to know how to evaluate probabilities. And I was using the earthquake as an example of something of a similar probability range, in other words, in the 5 to 15% range. And I was simply explaining that when we see something in the 5 to 15% range, we don't assume it won't happen. We've assumed in the case of the earthquake that it will happen, and we're planning accordingly. And I'm requesting that in this case, we plan accordingly. And certainly, it's nothing that would require the sort of mobilization of the size of an M9 earthquake.
Others? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the work that you've done on this.
Thank you, Chair Beyer.
Okay, that concludes our agenda for the day. Is there anything else for the good of the business? Good.
I think we're good, Mr. Chair. Oh, with one other exception, just a reminder that the deadline for submitting bill draft requests to Ledge Council is a week from today, the 22nd.
A week from today. With that, we are adjourned.
One more time, Isaac. One more time, Isaac.
With that, we are adjourned.